This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers. Mixtape Massacre: Escape from Tall Oaks, the upcoming sequel to the cult favorite board game Mixtape Massacre, is now live on Kickstarter. But this time, the tables have turned. In this meta-cooperative game, players are placed in the shoes of Tall Oaks survivors, fighting off slashers, rescuing helpless residents, and safeguarding the town, all in an attempt to escape the maddening streets of Tall Oaks or die trying. Though working together at times, in the end, only one will be able to make their escape. Along with new mechanics, the fan-favorite killer scenes and bonus tracks are back, keeping the game retro, fun, and full of jokes and horror tropes. Own the original game, extend the town by combining both games, and turn your next game night into a slashers versus survivors party. Welcome back to Tall Oaks, now run like hell. Mixtape Massacre: Escape from Tall Oaks is currently live on Kickstarter until April 5th. Head on over to visittalloaks.com or mixtapemassacre.com to learn more and back the Kickstarter.
April 30th, Severin Films is swinging open the doors of the Insane Asylum and releasing killer Kiwi classic Death Warmed Up, my favorite New Zealand title, from the standard definition prison it's been trapped inside for decades. This Blu-ray edition has been remastered by director David Blythe himself from the only existing elements and comes loaded with exclusive new special features. 3 years before Peter Jackson's bad taste, Death Warmed Up sprayed international movie screens with brains, blood, and bizarre body fluids for the first splatter movie in Kiwi history. A special edition with limited slip available for pre-order from www.severin-films.com, and other April releases include Emmanuel and Francois Escape from a Woman's Prison and the Hemisphere Box of Horrors.
Out now from Exploitation Restoration Specials Vinegar Syndrome are four new Blu-ray sleaze classics. First, from the director of Logan's Run, Michael Anderson's atmospheric supernatural revenge film Dominique, starring Cliff Robertson. Plus, In the Cold of the Night, an off-the-wall proto-Skinamax jaw-dropper from the legendary cult filmmaker Nico Mastrakis, along with Francis Terry's gore-filled lo-fi creature feature The Suckling, in a never-before-seen restoration from its original negative. And finally, Andy Milligan's epic of urban debauchery, Fleshpot on 42nd Street, presented fully uncut for the first time ever. Also out next month is a bloody and twist-filled giallo from acclaimed filmmaker Juan Antonio Bardem, The Corruption of Chris Miller, an underseen masterpiece of early 70s Euro horror in a brand new 4K restoration and in its original scope framing for the first time on home video. Remember that Vinegar Syndrome might soon be in a city near you, from Cinema Wasteland to Monster Palooza to Texas Frightmare, as well as plenty of other conventions and events. Be sure to visit vinegarsyndrome.com for exclusive deals, astounding sales, merch, and the latest and greatest in exploitation home video releases.
IFC Midnight brings the wind to theaters, iTunes, and VOD on April 5th. Babel, Eater of Bones, Ariok, Bringer of Vengeance, Mara, Dammer of Souls, There's Something Waiting Outside the Door. A demonic evil haunts the homestead in this chilling folklorish tale of madness, paranoia, and otherworldly terror. IFC Midnight is the leading distributor of genre entertainment in the U.S., responsible for modern-day classics like The Babadook, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and Ghost Stories. So be sure to check out The Wind, coming to theaters, iTunes, and VOD on April 5th.
I'm your host, Rob G. And this is Becca McKendry. Hello.
No, this is Becca McKendry.
Oh, okay. It doesn't matter, really.
This is weird,
I'm your shadow self.
Hey, guys. It's Ryan.
The tethered. We're all tethered.
I think somebody is getting off on this right now.
They are.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. you're listening to Shockwaves. This is episode 138. And a few moments ago, I just learned for the first time that apparently people go to YouTube to listen to people whisper.
Yes, EMSR, that's a whole thing.
What is it called? EMSR or something?
Yeah.
EMSR. Thank you, Ernie.
Yeah. It's a thing?
You know how people listen to our show at 1.5 speeds? Some people would listen to it whisper mode.
Really?
So if we could make more money by selling to the whisper market.
So I should read the IFC ad.
I think we should do it.
Let's do it again. Ads all sides. Yes.
Death Warmed Up.
All right. Well, you are listening to the fully volumed Shockwaves. I'm Rob Galuzzo. Elric Kane is with me.
How's it going, Rob?
Hello. Ryan Turek.
What's up?
Rebecca McKendry.
Hello.
And even Ernie's back in the recorder's chair.
Oh.
Got to give props to Ernie.
Yay.
Why not? He may fall asleep at some point.
That's okay.
Or...
It's a long
we love
day.
Ernie. And it's a lot of shit in this room, guys. I may fall asleep.
He records five podcasts a day. So
he does.
This is true. This is true. A man of many podcasts.
But none are as exciting as ours.
That's yes. Right.
That's
exciting.
True.
Exciting. So a lot to talk about. Before we delve into movies, top of the show mentions, man, Larry Cohen.
Oh, dude, that was a rough
can't
week.
Deal with anymore.
We done. Just talked about him 2 minutes ago, and then you brought up I totally forgot him again, and now I feel sad again. Damn
I'm
it.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah. Larry Cohen, unfortunately, no longer with us.
As I said, he can write himself out of any corner, and that's what I loved about Larry's spirit.
I mean, if you can, go back. He was on episode 18 of Shockwaves. Still one of my favorite interviews. He was so yes, much fun, amazing. So mm-hmm. sharp, so many great stories. And I always felt inspired every time I heard him talk because just the way that kind of his career – whether it be writing or directing, kind of just like unfolded in this almost unnatural way, which mm-hmm. you could see in the documentary King Cohen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of like things just don't happen like that anymore. And I don't know. I mean, Elric, maybe you could talk a little bit because you had more interaction with him than all of us.
I had him on he was one of my
what
first
he did
guests.
At your,
but even before that, one of my first show here, I think when me and Ryan first ever exchanged any kind of message was when you were talking about the host of the show. And, it was the best of – I can't even remember what it was. But Larry had come on that, and it was a great way. Somebody gave me his contact, and I call him up. And I remember this is like 7-8 years ago. And he says, yeah, sounds great. Just send me a fax. And then he hangs up. And I'm like, oh, shit. Do they still do faxes?
Yes.
Because he doesn't do email. And it took me forever to get him a fax. And then he came on the show. And he was as entertaining. And he seemed as same age as when we had him just last time. I mean, that's the thing about somebody – when somebody passes who seems just eternally youthful, it's a little more shocking, I think, because there wasn't like an old bone in that guy's body. And it's just so much fun to talk to him. When he came to the cafe, it clearly meant something to him, and I don't think that's always the case when you're going to some small little hole in the wall.
Yeah.
Luckily for us, a lot of people have seemed to – like even Carpenter seemed to say that. But I think with Larry, it's a little more special because he did a live reading, and I've got two signed copies actually, a 2-jump cut from him of his script, Movie House I think it was called, that he cast with
unproduced.
Professional actors.
Yeah, it was phenomenal.
Never made it. Super fun.
That was like a touching night because it was just this moment of listening to this wonderful story. It was a meta piece where it was a people watching a movie that was kind of reflecting murders that were taking place in the actual movie house at the same time. And it was definitely like of its age, but it felt wonderful.
Well, I think, and he tied it all together with one line about like what about his biography, where he's like, "Yeah, my mother, she like you know after she had me, she dropped me off at the movie theater and then she just left me there."
And then
it was just his way of saying like I grew up in a movie theater and I love, and then it made sense. He was showing something called Movie House, so he did that the one night. Then he did a workshop, so he let people bring in. It was a 2-night workshop where the one day he just kind of talked about writing, and then the next he let people bring in scenes. And the things that are most memorable is that a good friend of ours, Dick Grinert, was workshopping one, so it was fun for him. But then the one I remember most was a friend of the show,
Sean Keller,
had one that had so much basically graphic gay sex in it that Larry was really blushing, and I remember just thinking, "This is hilarious."
Well, because what was this? He gave a scenario.
There was
right?
a prompt. Yeah, there was some sort of prompt
like
that
a
around.
Couple fighting or something like that.
Yeah,
and he's like,
"All
right,
that.
Now go with that." And Sean showed him. He's like, "My couple is a gay couple,
and it was
and
awesome.
It's going to be graphic."
but you could, and it wasn't that Larry was against it. You could just tell that he was like a little shocked by how far some of the story. And it was just amazing to see a guy who's come up with the most outlandish stories on earth. Like, I mean, he can cue the winged serpent. Some of these stories are pretty wild. But it just seemed like an utter gentleman. And then it was really touching to see the film again, because then when he talks about his life, the fact that they just put that clip of him being there was what was touching. It doesn't mean it had that much significance to him, but in the context of the documentary, it does. And that's why I like that moment for me. But
let's go around the table. What's your favorite Larry Cohen film?
Directing wise, God Told Me To. As a writer, Maniac Cop 2.
Nice.
Easy, God Told Me To. I just think it's one of the greatest cult movies ever made. It's so crazy. I mean, I love the stuff, but the stuff is like, I love the first half, and then it gets all political. It's interesting.
It gets super bananas in the second half. I gotta say, Cue the Winged Serpent's probably my favorite, because it's just an introduction of giant monster movie in the streets of New York, and there's such a weird realism to all of the characters. Michael Moriarty's character, is kind of like walking into a bar and just having a casual New Yorker conversation, and
and a lot of tough guys, Carradine.
There's a lot of people in it, and I just love how they brought in like the kind of Aztec culture.
That's Richard Roundtree, actually, I think.
Carradine's
in it. Carradine is, but usually works with Fred Williamson. So I think I think this one is actually Shaft.
There's a moment, I think it's in Q, where Carradine is. they're getting ready to gear up, and they're heading up into the Chrysler Tower. And Carradine like looks at one of the cops, and he's like, "Yeah, it's fun, right?"
And the stories about the Chrysler building are crazy. Listen to that when you watch the Larry Cohen documentary. I mean, that is outrageous.
What about you, Becca?
Stuff by far. I definitely, it's in like my top 10 films. Yeah.
I think it's one of the most. And the one that we're not talking about, I mean, It's Alive is very close.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
I think that's a nearly perfectly made small movie.
I also have to. Yeah, I have to give love to The Ambulance as well, which is not like a well known Larry Cohen film.
It's a cool
but I absolutely loved that film in the 90s. Yeah. I remember we had a VHS copy, and I probably watched that as much as I did The Stuff.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, last night I watched It's Alive again, and I've always liked the movie, but I guess growing up I always preferred kind of the sequels because of where they go.
They're more bonkers.
But last night was like the first time where the original It's Alive really clicked with me, and I realized how great of not thinking of it in the context of a trilogy and just as its own movie. I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Right.
And then I immediately put on the remake they did a few years ago.
Oh, I've never seen that.
And I didn't finish it. But it shows literally approaching the exact same material, only one works and one does not at all.
Oh, yeah. I think the opening sequence of It's Alive is one of the best directed sequences in a horror film. Just everything he's doing with the everyone being cleared out of this room and the anxiety of the dad. Yeah. And then where it lands is pretty touching for a horror film. So it's he's just a great mind.
Well, what was great was the trajectory of the It's Alive trilogy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it begins in the home and literally kind of ends in the courthouse.
Yep.
You know, and you're on an island too. But it just like it affects this country on a much wider level. It's just really interesting.
Even just looking over his stuff now, I'm always so impressed with his writing. Like, that's honestly where I think that Larry kind of just went crazy. Like, he did the Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake that Abel Ferrara did. He did Phone Booth, which I always thought was a super tight movie. So just some of the ones that you don't even really associate him with. I mean, the
bestseller's really good thriller if you're looking for a really fun, tight thriller. Yeah, no, he wrote a lot of stuff. We are going to do a little tribute on Pure Cinema where we're going to just pair five of his key movies with other movies.
Wow.
So that's going to be in like a couple weeks because we want to do something, you know?
That's great.
No, and I mean also Joe Pilato from Day of the Dead.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Choke on him.
Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the greatest villain performances of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was great because I talked about this on social media as well, but – you know, really early on in my kind of quote unquote, you know, early days of journalism and being a journalist, Ryan Rotten, I ran into Joe at like just a mutual friend's party. And I'll never forget. I was so starstruck. Actually, this might have been before I was writing for the internet, but I was just kind of like slowly ingratiating myself into the LA horror world. And a friend was like, come on over. Joe Pilato will be there. And I was like, Joe Pilato. And then I was like, fuck, that's Rhodes. And I walked over to him in the kitchen. And I was like, Mr. Pilato's such a huge fan. He turns around. He's got a beer in his hand. He goes, you're a fan? And I was like, I am. And he's like, all right, come here. I'm going to tell you some stories. And I was like, oh thank you. And he told me all these great stories from Day of the Dead and stuff. It was so cool. And then I would run into him at conventions. He was just always a nice guy.
He's also one of those villains that I, as a kid, actually hated him because the role is so convincing. In my mind, it's like, oh, that guy's a bad guy because that's how good a bad guy is. It's great.
Good stuff. But it's unfortunate that we lost
I didn't know he was
so
in Pulp Fiction. He's got a tiny part.
What is he in Pulp Fiction?
He's listed as Dean Martin, which means he's at the restaurant.
Oh, my gosh.
So next time you see Pulp Fiction, Joe Pilato is in that scene apparently, which is kind of
that has to be a reference for Quentin then.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, there was also the connection, the From Dusk Till Dawn connection. He was supposed to be with the Gecko Brothers.
Yeah, the original pitch film. I think Bloody Disgusting had just shared it, but because it was From Dusk Till Dawn was created by Robert Kirkman from K&B, and so he did a little pitch film that he directed, and Seth Greco is Joe Pilato in the pitch film.
Yeah. Oh,
so it's only a couple minutes long, but it's kind of like a teaser trailer.
It was on that special. There was a DVD, two disc DVD.
Oh yeah, I think it's on there too.
Yeah.
Man, where do we go from there?
Yeah. I'm
like, no one else die, please.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Well, all right. We have plenty of things we could talk about.
Yes.
I'd like to assume that we all saw the number one movie in America right now.
Yes.
Us.
Us.
U.S. Us?
Yes.
We've all seen it?
Yes.
Okay, great.
And so we're going to talk
spoilers. How do we talk about it?
Yeah, without mentioning anything.
Well, because like Elric, I had seen the first trailer, uh-huh. which really didn't give that much away. I didn't really have any context, and I refused to watch anything else after that.
Oh, I didn't know you did.
And I'm glad. No, because that one, it was like, nope, I want to be surprised. Yeah. Like, I knew from judging from Get Out, I knew that I was going to get something interesting and different, and I just – that little taste from that first teaser was enough for me to be like, all right, cool. I'm in. I don't want to know anything else.
Yeah.
I want to be surprised. And so I went to see it. I had a very wonderful, lively audience that really got into it. I mean, I loved it. I'll just start there.
Yeah.
How did everyone else feel about it?
I, too, loved it.
Yeah.
I like because he's dealing with a lot more ideas, like I feel like if Get Out is like you hit the bullseye because you're aiming for a bullseye because you're dealing with one issue, this hits like just outside the bullseye, but also because you're not trying to hit a bullseye. Like I feel like he's trying to hit a bunch of social issues and still be incredibly entertaining. Like to me, it's funny as hell. I was laughing all the way through. I could totally identify with the dad character.
Us?
Yeah.
Us. Oh, yeah. People are laughing.
There's a lot of humor.
The
family dynamics are hilarious.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. But I think there's a part where that peters out and it becomes...
Only maybe in the very last, like, 20 minutes. It's so hard to talk about without spoilers, but there's another family in it who are hilarious. Like, I mean, they cast Tim Heidecker and the
Oh,
the
my gosh.
Actress,
that whole scene with them, the audience was dying.
We have to be careful because everything is loaded with spoilers.
We can talk about the basics of Delvin and Son.
Right.
It is a doppelganger movie for the most part. Yeah.
And the social, and you know, there are basic social messages, but I think there are some that are like more like clues throughout where you're like watching it going, oh, I kind of feel like I know what that is, but I don't. And then you read afterwards and go, oh, that's really enriching. And I have friends, you know, friends who are really close taste wise to me who just absolutely went the other way.
Yeah. I had a lot of friends dislike it. And I understand the complaint because I felt that same way for moments because, and this is not a spoiler, you go through the whole movie kind of not knowing what's going on. And then in the third act, there is a very short moment where they start trying to explain everything. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting in the theater going, stop doing that. Stop. You're killing my stop. I was enjoying this until it got there.
But Becca, they gave you a split diopter shot to explain it.
I know. And it was fucking beautiful.
I always wanted
beautiful.
To tweet that, but I didn't know if that would be a spoiler to be like, if you're going to do an exposition scene,
you
use a split diopter, and then no one gives a shit.
No, and it was beautifully shot. But... And I saw that that's where people started bumping is as soon when it was just chaos going on, when it was, I'll call it an It Follows level of chaos where this is just happening and we don't really know why it's happening.
Yeah, it becomes a stalk and slash movie in the central part, like
exactly.
A traditional horror movie.
I feel like
home invasion horror.
First half is home invasion horror. Second half becomes a Twilight Zone episode accurate way.
Which I was totally into. And as soon as those short moments of explainers came in, I think that it opened up this door of people trying to create logic within those explainers.
Which actually
but that said,
is fair. I actually think that's fair because it's one of the problems why we always say don't explain horror. There's not all of the exposition does this, but there's a couple of things where if you invite logic, then people start thinking logically for a moment. I think your brain is lost in the mystery of a horror film. Then you start becoming analytic. It can hurt it, but it only took me out for a second. And then I'm so into the craft, the music, performances. I just think it's a beautiful film.
And I think that's
people's biggest complaint is that the exposition and then kind of a sucker punch, I'll call it, at the end, which makes you rethink everything.
It's totally earned.
And it is totally earned. And that's, to me, it's like, it's very rare. I'm amazed how divisive it is, but it's very rare that I can't stop thinking about a movie and do want to see it again and analyze it. I think Get Out was the – I'm going to choose my words carefully. I think Get Out's the better movie in terms of a better popcorn movie. But like in terms of ambition and craft, I think – Us is the one we're going to talk about longer and analyze.
I've heard people comparing this to The Shining, which you don't hear a lot.
I disagree.
You don't think it's The Shining?
I haven't seen any movie that compares The Shining.
I have seen that said more than once on Twitter.
I think the part they're talking about is because there's a lot of theories. So the way The Shining made all these crazy theories, like the room 237.
And all the connectivity and how everything means something later.
But in this
case,
they really do because Jordan Peele's very clearly, I mean, down to the glove, the Michael Jackson shirts.
The videotapes that are placed in the opening scene.
There's all these things that are just,
I think, I mean, like, this is one of the – we're talking about a Blumhouse movie, and I'm kind of remaining silent just because it's like it's a – you know, it's a Monkey Paw production, you know, and Blumhouse is – Jason's involved. But it was like one of the first movies that kind of came through here that I did not read the script. I didn't know anything about it. I kind of went in cold. Bea Sequeira, who's our other executive here, she kind of, you know, was like the main exec on it along with Jason. And And, you know, she sits right next to me in the office, and she was like doing all this us stuff. And I was like, I don't want to, I'm just kind of staying away from all these things that you're talking about. I don't want to know much about it. So I kind of went in cold like everybody else. I had no idea what the movie was about. And I got to say, the first time I saw it, you know, to me, it felt like Jordan Peele's Night of the Living Dead. It's, you know, in terms of like the kind of
I think it's the most Romero-esque film too.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. It's like the most Romero, the Romero-esque thing. And there are little bits and pieces. I mean, there are a lot of Easter eggs, a lot more than what people are talking about. I had her break down a few that I was like, oh, fudge. I got to go back and see it. And Jordan even like slipped a few my way too. And I was like, oh my God, I missed that too. But I do want to call him out because there is a VHS tape at the very beginning of the film. That is Chud. It's a video treasures release.
Daniel Del Pozzo went crazy about this, right? Daniel Del Pozzo does all the tape trading. And so he went crazy. I saw Ant Timpson post that too. He's like, oh God, look who's coming to ruin the new Jordan Peele movie.
What, did that version not come out?
Yeah, it hadn't
not
come
until
out.
After, right? No, until after.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's a movie, guys.
But that's a movie.
No, it's fine. But no, I feel like, you know, my takeaway is like, this is his most Romero-esque film.
I totally agree. Like, that was the number one director that I walked out going, oh, he's making films about ideas, but he has the craft and the monsters to back it up. And I also think the performance, especially when the characters come into the house, the key how do you say her last name? Alonga? Alonga?
Lupita
Nyong'o? Her performance in that moment to me is like on that level with what Toni Collette did last year, where I was just like going, oh, yes. 100%. And what she does with her voice work and stuff, I think it's a beautiful performance. I can understand someone going, oh, yeah, just because of some of the ideas, it's too much for me. But the idea of not enjoying this is hard for me as just a horror film lover. It gave me so many great scenes, so many great moments, great characters.
Yeah.
For me, I can't really see it.
You know? Yeah. I mean, a lot of people seem to the people that are going down the logic route then pick out quote unquote plot holes, and that's why they don't like it. But I don't know. I'm one of those people that I go into a theater. I don't want to guess the ending. I'm not looking for the flaws. I let go and I just want to go for the ride. I just want to see what the experience is going to be. If it's going to be a fast roller coaster or a sharp turn, like I don't want to see it coming. Right. So I just kind of like let go and enjoy it. And I really didn't think that hard about it after. I mean, I did. Of course, there's ideas and sequences and thoughts. I mean, there's so many subliminal – you know, you could watch it and not get political, but it's hard. I mean, you know, it's a bunch of people in red literally forming a wall at one point.
Well, there's a key line that one of the characters says where it becomes instantly political early on and when they break in the house. So, you know, I won't go there, but it's not impossible not to be political. That's why I do think the Romero – it's funny because Get Out's the one we were initially going, oh, it's Romero's because where the ending was headed. But this one is far more of a Romero film than Get Out.
Get Out is more Stepford Wives.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I do love the score. It reminded me – it's not like it, but it reminded me – first of all, I can't stop listening to it. But like The Omen, The Omen has all that like chanting and stuff to it, and it's catchy. I loved it. I loved it.
And if you 100%. Are looking for articles, Shadows and Act is one of the online sites. And a woman wrote – I can't remember her name right now, but she wrote a really cool write-up analysis of it. And you know,
There have been quite a few that I've been digging online, which – I mean, look, you can't deny it. I mean, the fact that this much discussion is being done over a movie that was as successful as it was, whether you like it or not, it's kind of – I mean, we're looking at an interesting milestone for horror.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this one will go down historically like a lot of people are saying. Like, is this one that is still going to be a topic in 10 years or something that defines the decade?
I feel like, I mean, if he keeps making movies, you want him to be our Carpenter from this generation's Carpenter, where he'll make like eight or ten amazing movies you'll come back to and see new things in. And, you know, I think that'd be great.
But that's what I love is like he's, you know, it was so funny when I got home from Us, I'm looking at my Blu-ray shelf and the first thing that popped out to me was Keanu. So I'm like, oh, yeah, remember he made that movie?
I love that movie.
He didn't direct it.
No, he wrote it.
So it doesn't count.
It's a Key and Peele movie more than anything. But that's the point is like, what I love is like here's a guy that is known for comedy, made a horror movie, which most directors only do to break into directing, and is like, no, I'm going to make horror movies. I'm going to keep making horror movies. I got to make this movie and this movie. Yeah. No, he's all in on horror, and it's very rare. And right down to tweeting us as a horror movie. Mm-hmm. Because everyone's like, oh, it's a thriller. No, it's horror.
Yeah.
Then he's going to do Twilight Zone.
How is Us not a horror movie?
I mean, come on. Every major outlet that wants to.
I think everybody's,
not,
everybody's lost their minds. Yeah. Everybody's lost
pretty
their
much.
Minds.
Pretty much.
What about reboots and remakes? You want to talk about
you
that?
You want to talk about
oh,
that?
Hey, I saw that was those a great Twitter
you
thread.
Want me to, you want me to lay down on that? I mean, Jesus. Yeah, this is this
so
weekend.
You guys are doing The Craft. Let's start with that. That's a big deal.
We're doing The Craft reboot.
Are you able to tell what happened? Because I remember years ago, the woman who was making Honeymoon was
Legenia.
Whatever happened to that version? Did it just run out of steam?
Sony.
Okay.
I mean, like, we're doing this with Sony.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, Sony, you know, whatever the version they had developed with her is not what we're
happening.
Doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So then Lee is directing, apparently, all three Fear Street movies over at Fox now. So,
wow, yeah. That is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, I think Bloody Disgusting reported that. Okay. But, yeah, it was just like, it was surprising to me that in the wake of so many good reboots and so many, you know,
Pet Sematary and
just so many films that are coming out, like that are, you know, kind of taking what's old and putting a new spin on them. There's still this kind of stigma of going, there's no original ideas being made when all I need to do
is
look at the box office and go, look at us, you know. And I even cited Rob's thing. I was like, I was like, Rob over at Epic is acquiring original horror films. We are making literally a horror film a month for Hulu. We are
I tweeted that too. I mean, yeah. Shudder, IFC Midnight.
It's just like the list goes on and on. And it's just like, don't be lazy about it. Go and explore. Yeah. Just because it's not being fed to you on Twitter or being fed to you on social media and not being fed to you as soon as you open your laptop doesn't mean you can't just do a simple like little exploration on your Google search of, you know, great horror films. There are plenty of horror websites out there that are working diligently to bring you recommendations. I mean, this very podcast is all about bringing you recommendations of horror films that you may not have never seen before that are original.
Yes. But you would agree that there's five elevated horror films that saved horror, right? Because that's that? Another article where you read it and go, what? Like The Witch saved horror? Like, what was happening to horror?
This is all random.
Enough of that.
Yeah, but anyways, there are just as many great original horror films being made out there as there are reboots.
Well, I'd say more than ever.
And more than ever.
Yeah, I would definitely. I'd say right now we're getting saturated with horror right now. This is a beautiful time. Yeah. And especially if you're looking for originality, television. I am seeing so much original stuff come out of television right now that it's just dominating.
Well, by the time you listen to this, I mean, this episode will be available on Friday. I think that Jordan's Twilight Zone debuts this weekend.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, April 1st.
Technically a reboot, right?
Wait, so how do I get it? Do I have to buy the CBS Access thing?
You have to have CBS Access.
See, I'm actually going to do it.
For $5 a month.
I'm going to end up doing the same thing with What We Do in the Shadows releases today. On FX.
They were recording, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm Jones.
So this is different than
that.
His other TV show.
Also a
Wellington
reboot.
Paranormal is different, right?
This has nothing to do with that, but I think that it's the same people,
same
but this is a completely...
It's Taika and everybody spearheading a What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah,
TV
it's
show.
The same IP, but this is specifically for FX.
Yeah, new cast. Interesting.
It looks fun.
Yeah.
I'll lose the Kiwi accent, so that's not good.
Speaking of sequels and reboots.
Okay.
What do you got?
I was going to talk about a little show that both of us watched.
Oh, you're not talking about the little creatures?
Do we want to go right
critters
into
and new
Critters?
Binge.
Oh,
new
how binge? Is the new Critters show, guys?
Not good
four
at
stars.
All.
Four stars.
Oh.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be so blunt about it that way. Well, first of all, it's a Shudder.
So,
okay, you go.
It's a Shudder acquisition because you and I talked about this just before we came on the show.
Yes.
I looked it up.
Yes.
The fact that they're doing, not Shudder, but I don't know what it is, Sci-Fi, is doing a separate film.
Yes.
That is no relation to this series.
How did they split the IP?
I got very nervous about that.
That's Warner Brothers and New Line. That's whatever they want to do. Because initially, my understanding of what the Critters series was a digital endeavor spearheaded by Warner Brothers and New Line that was going to live wherever, you know, and then Shudder acquired it. So, you know, and then whatever they're going to do with the film is a completely separate beast altogether. Maybe
thank you for clarifying because I looked it up. It was back in October of 2018 that Bloody Disgusting broke the scoop that Sci-Fi was doing a new Critters movie and a new Killer Clowns movie.
Right.
And so I just thought they took the Critters movie and cut it up into 10-minute segments for this series.
That's what I thought when I watched the first one.
But it's thankfully Ryan reiterated that's not that because I got really nervous about Killer Clowns if that was the case. But no, those are apparently two movies that are still coming.
Yeah.
Movies.
Yeah.
But this show,
how all the mechanics behind it, I have no idea how they exist or whatever and who's behind it, but it's a film is apparently coming. So.
But that kid really likes to eat.
Have you watched it?
I watched episode one, and I will not be finishing.
Critters. So you don't know why he likes to eat.
God.
It's a wonderful twist.
You need to find out.
Kidding me.
Oh, my God.
Critters, A New Binge is a short form digital series spearheaded by Jordan Rubin, who gave us Zombievers.
That's why there's a poster of that in the first episode.
Exactly.
Oh.
And it follows a young teenage boy who encounters the critters who are after him for a very specific reason. Meanwhile, you've got the intergalactic bounty hunters that are after the critters. So it's a big chain of people chasing other people.
I just worked up the whole thing just from what you told me. I get it now. Yeah.
Do the critters look cool at least?
They look pretty similar.
Yeah, they're fine. They're hand puppets. Here's the thing about this. I actually think the scripting of it is actually pretty – like I think it's pretty funny, like the idea that they go with it. I think
Gilbert Gottfried's in it.
Gilbert Gottfried's the uncle.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
What's your problem?
It's kind of funny and quirky and like I kind of like the writing of it for what it is, but it's the budget that shows. Like the bounty hunters just look terrible.
Special effects are so bad.
Yeah, it's like
the VFX are so terrible.
If only they had somebody spectacular on this new show to do it. But yeah, that's what hurts it is you immediately watching like, oh, this feels like a web series or like a fan thing. But I mean, puppet stuff is funny to me because they're subtitled. They're all yelling at each other.
There's one part where I did almost do like a spit take because the kid is like, he's talking to a critter. He's like, we need to go back. And the critter's wearing a translator. And the critter just goes, nope. And the way the delivery of it just really cracked me up that I backed it up and watched it again. But it's very lowbrow. All Gilbert Gottfried's jokes are mostly like dick and Viagra jokes, you know. I don't know. I mean, like, what I did appreciate is that you could watch them in 8-minute chunks because that's basically the length of them all.
Yeah, that's
really?
All it is.
That's an interesting screening platform.
Well, again, remember, this was supposed to be for digital.
Okay.
You know, so it's not quite the return of the critters that I wanted.
No, I mean, I guess if you – yeah, it's fun in its own way, but the problem is, like, we just got that box set of the original movies, and I still stand by that first movie.
Oh, my
like,
God. The first movie is awesome.
It's brilliant.
I love
by it. First two.
Yeah.
It's a steep drop off after two, though.
Yeah, very steep.
But Ryan, they went to college.
No, wait, that was a coolie.
It was a joke. It was a joke, guys.
You gave me heart palpitations here.
Didn't mean to mix up my franchise there, boys.
But then I was like, again, munchies. You're either a Munchies, Ghoulies, or Critter person.
Yeah.
Where do you fall?
I'm Ghoulies. I was a Ghoulies person.
But the movies suck so bad, the first one. But the Ghoulies themselves are awesome.
Did you just say the movies suck so bad?
Ghoulies 1 is so boring.
Oh, my God. It's brilliant,
dude. I like Ghoulies 2 better.
Yeah, Ghoulies.
No, Ghoulies 1
is better. The first one is boring.
Excuse me. There are exploding hearts. There's things coming out of the toilet.
No,
it's got Satanists.
Cheesy pentagram.
It's got Marissa Haggerty. What do you want from a movie, Ron?
The commercial was better than the movie with the toilet.
Tagline.
That is Charlie Band's best.
The video programs were better than all of it.
And the one guy wearing sunglasses all the way through it. But I haven't seen Ghoulies go to college for a long time. I would rewatch that.
Elric is a munchie.
No, I'm definitely not a munchie.
Hobgoblins. Hobgoblin?
I'm
not a hobgoblin.
Are you a fuzz bucket? You're a fuzz bucket.
Maybe true. No, Critters 1 was, I just thought it was a brilliant movie. I thought it was just, you know, they have weapons, you know, so what? I think that those things were so iconic, you know? It's to me, I mean, we did talk once about the crossover would have been cool, Ghoulies versus Critters, but I guess. Never happened. So, is there any chance the movie can be good?
I don't know.
We hope. Yeah, fingers crossed.
I forgot who Bloody Disgusting. I forgot who Bloody Disgusting said was directing, but I was like, oh, okay, that seems cool. I don't
remember either.
Yeah.
I think it's part of the James Wan universe thing. But
you're starting rumors, dude.
That would be wonderful.
I'll tell you right now. The director is Bobby Miller, who directed The Cleanse, which was a interesting film.
That was a fascinating. It was a little too long.
Did you see The Cleanse?
Yeah. I saw it back for a festival.
It was like 3 hours.
It's interesting.
Long,
yeah. No, no, it wasn't.
Felt 3 hours. It was. Long.
It felt long.
But it had some cool stuff in there too. Some cool practical weird effects.
Yeah.
Beck, I've got a question for you. Why do you never take me to gay pornos?
You know what? I did take you to a gay porno this weekend.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Also have a giallo content to it?
It did.
Oh, my God. I heard about
this. Elric and I went to see gay porno this weekend.
My friend Oren.
Context, please. Context.
My friend Oren, a few days before, told me whatever you do, don't miss. We already had discussed this months ago
because
I'd heard at South By is really good. But Oren said, I guess his friend wrote it, and he said, oh, my. He went to it, and I go, is it going to be that kind of that cheesy throwback everything's like the 70s and they're really – and he went to it and he came back and he goes, dude, this is the real deal.
And what is that film?
That film
is
Knife
Plus Heart.
Knife Plus Heart.
And I'd been hearing about this one for months just because I'm such a huge giallo fan. This had been put on my radar and everybody kept telling me to see it. And a couple of my students had seen it at AFI Fest and then came back and were like, how have you not seen this? And so they were doing a double screening at the New Art of this film. And then afterwards they were playing the actual gay porn that apparently inspired
from
this.
The 70s, like from the 70s. Golden era. Yeah.
So the whole setup of Knife Plus Heart, I fucking loved this movie.
It's really cool.
I'm
a fan.
It was just really awesome.
Oh, you saw it too?
I saw it months ago.
I remember you mentioning it from South.
It played at Cannes Sundance, and then I chased it down and I saw it, but I had to be quiet about it because it was just kind of going around. But I absolutely love this movie. And I love the score by M83.
Oh my God, the score was so, it was just decadent.
But the lead actress is Vanessa Paradis, who Americans don't seem to know her as well. Except she was Johnny Depp's wife for a long time.
As a
pop star, she's huge, but she's in a great film called Girl on the Bridge from like late 90s, maybe early 2000s. So she's a good actress.
Yeah.
But in this, she's amazing. She's kind of like a blondie type.
Yeah, the whole setup is that she runs a gay porn house, that they are making blue movies. It's 1979. They are making blue movies in France. And she runs, and it's not even like high quality gay porn. They're making like B-level gay porn. But that she's got this group of actors that she always works with. They call it a company. Well, I would have said troupe.
Yeah, okay.
But they're a family, because they all appear in the same films and they all know each other and they're all very close. But one by one, somebody starts picking them off and they start dying. And the police start zeroing in on her, thinking that it must be her. At the same time, she is in love with her female editor on these films, but they're having some relationship problems.
And she's really intense.
Every
character
has got a drinking
really
problem.
Intense. But the killer, the first murder, you would definitely—it has to be a tribute to
cruising
because it's somebody being tied up from behind and in a very vulnerable spot. And then the killer has this incredible like leather mask and this like curly top hair. And I don't really want to ruin what the killing device is because it's just incredible.
It's
actually kind of scary. It's definitely got campy moments for sure, just by the nature of what they're making. But it also is creepy and stylish, and it just feels very original. It doesn't feel like you can easily place it in a subgenre.
No, yeah, this is something that I will definitely be talking about at the end of the year as something that is unlike anything else I have seen this year. And apparently it was based off this very classic gay porn from the 70s, which was playing right afterwards. And after we finished this movie, Elric and I were like, do you want to stick around for the gay porn? Well, probably not. So we left.
I said, hell yeah. And she was like, I'm out of here.
But. Well, it was late and it was a Sunday night. And so we were like, you know what?
There were a lot of dudes in that theater.
We have kids. Cool. We should, you know, get on home. And then afterwards I was so just inspired by this movie that I now really want to go back and watch that gay porn.
And Oren had said we should have, because he thinks that it really did have a lot of that. It was from that period where porns weren't just about sex, they were actually about storylines, and
it was like Beyond the Green Door, where it's like it's like a different level.
You could ask the Vinegar Syndrome guys when they're in a few weeks, because he stayed for it.
Oh, he did.
Oh, okay.
Oh, interesting.
I really want to know what it's about.
Do we know if our friends at Attack of the Queer Wolf thought?
We got to ask them.
Yeah. We should do a crossover and talk with them.
It hasn't come out very wide yet. I'm sure once it's on VOD, you will all get a chance. It must be soon. So.
It's got a couple more nights at the New Art, I'm fairly sure. It's still playing there. Yeah, 7:30 and 9:30.
It is the perfect kind of movie to see in a movie theater still, because like collective experience for how movies used to be in the 42nd Street era or the Midnight movie, that's how it really feels.
And they were actually, there's a wonderful scene in it, which I won't give too many spoilers, but there's a wonderful scene in it where she goes to see one of the movies and it's playing like a true porn where it's playing on the loop. Like it's a 10-minute movie, but they've got it playing on the loop. And she watches it like 4 times in a row. And it's a beautiful film.
Yeah. And also when it ends, you're like, whatever he makes next, I'm going to watch. Kind of like how I felt about Revenge last year. It's like, whatever you make, I'm going to watch it.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious what you do next.
Yeah, it was totally tight. Well.
Very cool movie.
Well, what is not as good as Knife Plus Heart that I saw was a 1982 slasher film called Honeymoon Horror. Honeymoon Horror.
I remember the VHS cover for this one.
Heather Buckley, thank you, Heather, gifted this to Ciara and I as a wedding present on VHS, and last night we watched it. She actually gifted us two VHS tapes, Honeymoon Horror and Honeymoon. Mm-hmm. Honeymoon also has an iconic VHS cover, which is just you'll see the
couple
laying on a bed, and there's a burning
heart
behind them. It basically looks like Ryan Reynolds' Deadpool with a mask off.
It is. I'm pretty sure it is.
What's his name? Wade something. In Honeymoon Horror, you've basically got a couple who own kind of like a honeymoon cabin. It's like a island getaway just off the – it's a little New England, like one of those little coastal islands. And her hubby is heading out for the evening. And what does she do? She slides right on over to the next cabin over and hooks up with this dude that she's been seeing for like the last couple of months or whatever. Hubby – forgets something, obviously, doubles back, notices his wife is gone. He's like, God damn it. He runs over to the next cabin, and sure enough, he catches them in the act. And a fight breaks out. Hubby goes down, and he gets kind of pushed into the fire. And the wife and her boyfriend are like, fine, we're just going to leave you there, burn, motherfucker.
Ooh.
And so we cut to
Vengeance story. All right.
Full-on vengeance story. So what we now have is the wife and her lover, and they're now married, come back to reopen the honeymoon cabin. You've got a bunch of sorority kids.
Throw them
of course you got to have those.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
1982.
Yeah. So you set up a bunch of sorority girls who are getting ready for their girlfriend because she just got married. They're basically paving the way for their arrival. They're going to decorate the cabin. Every single one of them gets picked off in the first 20 minutes by an unknown killer. And then we pick up with the arrival of more sorority kids and college kids. Right. And what you basically have here is a very boring story about a bunch of kids boning each other. Meanwhile, you've got the killer kind of – there were countless scenes of the killer kind of lurking behind a tree getting ready to pounce on someone. But then – that would-be victim is interrupted by a friend going, oh, there you are. And then the killer kind of scampers off into the night. So then you would go to the next scene, and it's someone kind of wandering off. Linda, where are you, Linda? And the killer is like hiding behind the bush, and you think the killer is going to get him. And then it's like, oh, there you are, Linda. And then the killer runs away. So you keep building up, and you know who the fucking killer is. It is the burned-ass husband who's back for revenge. You pepper it in with some bad dick jokes.
Is he ghost back or like burned husband lived back?
Burned husband lived back.
Okay.
Yeah. And you've got a bunch of well, the kills are kind of fun. You get like a good arm severing. You get a lot of bad dick jokes. You get lots of scenes of just couples hanging out in bed. You know, there's a lot of that. That's the drama.
What I look for in my horror movies.
Yeah. And then you get Elric's video. And then you've got possibly the most inept and cop since Last House on the Left.
Oh.
And we know how bad.
Becca saying Keystone Cops.
Keystone Cops.
That's a drinking game
that's
online.
That's a drinking game.
So these Keystone. There's the cover.
And actually, this is how we can get the covers on now.
Wait, and there's Ryan Reynolds as the burnt killer.
Deadpool.
Yeah,
my
Deadpool.
Phone died straight away. So.
That's actually the best look I have of him yet. I mean, like the VHS copy, I can't really see that well.
That's actually pretty cool.
But the cops here are able to chew hamburgers and smoke cigars at the same time.
That's a talent.
Yes. The film kind of wraps up at the – I don't know what the running time is, but a film wraps up and you're like, well, this is it. Credits are going to roll. No. We stick around with the Keystone Cops for like an additional 10 minutes as they explain what had happened, where some of the bodies lay. There's actually something that happens off screen that they have to explain, but you never see it because they're like, where did this body go? And then a guy comes in. He's like, I found it, and this is what happened. And you're like, wait a second. Shouldn't I be seeing this pivotal piece of action? No, not at all. So anyways, Honeymoon Horror, not a treat.
So that was on VHS, you sir.
That was only
so
on
no
VHS.
One can see it on.
Yeah. Vinegar syndrome. We might have Vinegar Syndrome on, and it'll be like,
they'll
so we found this
it.
Gem.
Yeah.
Ugh. I saw a couple of Vinegar Syndrome. We started. you'll actually appreciate this. We started one that they had one of their picks of their favorites when they came on. Runaway Nightmare.
Oh yeah,
that's
yeah.
with Dick Renner. We watched the first 20 minutes of it, and we looked at each other at a certain point and decided to stop it because, it's about a worm farmer. anyway, I will return to the storyline in a moment because there is a good twist here. So we stopped it. So if they're listening, they're going to be horrified right now. But we put on Splatter University.
Yes.
Which ticked all the kind of boxes that it should with the title Splatter University. The funny part is, right now, I couldn't tell you one freaking thing about that movie. I've like totally forgotten it, even though it's totally like fine and enjoyable in the moment. So when it ended, the choice was everyone could go home now. And I said, you know what? I keep thinking about that first 20 minutes of Run
That Run
Run Nightmare.
I was really gravitating to that worm farmer.
There's something about the weird tone of that 20 minutes that made us shut it off that I wanted to revisit. And so luckily, they acquiesced. We put this thing back on. And while – when I gave it 3 stars later that night, and he literally wrote to me, 3 stars! That's a 1-star movie! Okay, imagine if David Lynch –
wait, what is the name of the worm farmer again?
Runaway Nightmare.
Runaway Nightmare.
It's two guys who are in the middle of the desert on a worm farm. But they're like shooting guns and just hanging out going, this is a boring job. Who would have thought? And then suddenly they look over the rock and see two guys burying a coffin or kind of a big box. And they're like, oh, that's unusual, given there's no one for miles. They wait till they leave. They go down. There's a beautiful naked woman inside the coffin that's just been buried, and she's alive but unconscious. So they take they're about to take her home to try to help her out. And then four leggy, buxom ladies with guns come up behind them and go, hey, we got you, suckers. And you're like, huh? And takes them home to their weird, like, cult. I guess they're a cult, but they're kind of like a militant feminist group, right? So now the worm farmers are with the feminist group.
I'm so in.
I know.
Yeah. I don't even know what's going on
this,
right now.
This part happened around the 20-minute mark, so you should be in. But then what happens is it's basically if David Lynch had no timing, but it's all the Lynchian and no aesthetic, sorry. So imagine Lynch without timing and aesthetic, and you'd have just like, you know, a fat woman suddenly cackling and then not cackling and looking at you weirdly. Has all those kind of moments that you'd see in a movie, or like the old people doing something weird. And yet none of it lands. And then at a certain point, what I started to believe that he didn't believe is like, this guy's really actually trying to make a movie. Like, it's still a bad movie, but he's really got an intent to his weirdness. Dick just thinks it's a bad movie. But I'm like, no, I think this guy has like this utter vision, and it is utterly bonkers. And by the end, I just kind of wish there was more. I was like, I'd love to screen this with a group. But it if you see the poster, it's a complete ripoff of Kiss Me Deadly.
I was going to say, I have seen this poster before.
And there is an ongoing joke. Well, we thought it was just bad writing, but luckily it ended up being a joke. But the whole way through they go, so what did the gangsters steal? Because I guess these girls are going to go chase down some mafia guys who are transporting platinum. And every time it comes up, what are they transporting? Platinum. And I'm like always looking at Dick going, platinum? Like, what is platinum's worth? And lo and behold, spoiler, at the very end of the movie, he goes, oh, you meant plutonium. And I just sat there and go, thank God that was in there. Otherwise, I would have thought this was the, you know. And of course, the ending, oh, no, it's not the very ending, but the poster art you get to see, which is somebody opening a box and light coming out, which is the classic.
They open the plutonium?
They open this box and, so, you know, you get your Kiss Me Deadly scene where, but after this movie ended, I started going, you know, everyone thinks Pulp Fiction is referencing Kiss Me Deadly, but I think he's referencing Runaway Train.
Yes.
Runaway Nightmare, whatever that was. Yeah. Because only Tarantino would be that deep cutty. because, I mean, it's really not a good movie, but I got to say, I truly walked away from it going, no, this is a really interesting, because another great part, you're watching a movie 20 minutes in, the worst actor on screen who's also the lead, and I just turned to Dick and I go, I bet you that's a fucking director. And then he looks it up, yep, that's the director. And it's like, you can just tell when somebody puts themselves as the lead in a movie and they're just not good. And he had this bad Jimmy Stewart impersonation going on the whole movie. He's like, we got to get out of here. And you're just like, what is this?
Mike Cartel.
Little research after the movie for completists.
Oh, yes.
He did rehearse and audition for the role Jeff Bridges ended up getting in Fat City by John Huston. He did not get it, so he made Runaway Nightmare.
Wow.
That is his whole filmography in a nutshell.
That's what happens
God
when you don't cast him.
I have this on Blu-ray now.
You have to watch it. And this
so
would
this
be
is
one
a
of your
Vinegar Syndrome release.
Yes, both of them were.
And can I tell you the IMDb synopsis?
Yes.
After you did a wonderful job, it just says, two dorky Nevada worm wranglers are kidnapped by a gang of beautiful women as part of a plot to steal plutonium from the mafia.
That says plutonium on there.
Okay.
See, that's the problem. It should say platinum, otherwise it's spoiler.
I'm kind of into that log line, though, guys.
Yeah,
that was a pretty tight log line.
It's very strange. strange, but it's pretty, you know, it has these little flourishes where you're like, I think he's doing this on purpose. Like moments that even the lighting on certain scenes, it's like, oh, okay. Ugh. Anyway, but that's what's funny is Splatter University is a better in quote marks movie. And yet like you I walk away with nothing. Yeah. I'm just like, yeah, it's a slasher and there's some priests. And
I just remember the windowsill moment.
That part was hilarious. So you already did a good job in that one. I actually think, you know, for completists like Ryan who need to see all slasher films, you should definitely still watch it. But it didn't like,
but I gotta be honest, you just sold me on Runaway.
No, I want to sell you on Runaway. I will stand by that this is an interesting movie, and you can tweet why Dick Renner's wrong.
Well, I'll probably pick it up at Texas Frightmare.
Yes.
Do it.
Runaway Nightmare. Becca, what do you got?
I got two quick horror adjacent titles I will mention.
Oh, boy. That means they're going to be musicals?
No, actually, the first one.
Not horror at all.
First one is, it's a total thriller. Buzz Wallach's film, Twin Sanity. It's on Netflix right now.
Okay.
I can't call it horror because it's not ghosts and, you know, it's not like crazy, you know, worm farmers or anything like that. It's two twins who start trying to kill each other. They reach a point in their life. It's literally like Sweet Valley High if the two twins at one point just went like, you're a bitch, and then they started trying to come up with different ways to like kill each other.
Nice.
And so it's fun. It's a domestic thriller. It's made by the same company that I just made the one that I did through, and which Buzz was the producer on. But yeah, it's a trip. I've been watching people tweet about it for the past couple of days since it's been online, and all of the responses have been like, holy shit, this is just like Sweet Valley High if they hated each other and wanted each other to die. Yeah, so it's fun.
Yeah, that just got added to Netflix. That's why
that is on Netflix now, Twin Sanity. I'll also plug the book that I am currently reading, which I call Horror Adjacent just because it's nonfiction, and a lot of times people have bucked when I do that. But I am reading Wicked Plants this week. For Christmas, my parents gave me Wicked Plants and Wicked Bugs because they know me.
They do.
And it literally just goes through historical stories when plants have like completely killed people or really fucked up shit that plants do. And it's just got really fascinating stories in it. Like the fact that the entire Salem witch trials were basically because of ergo, which is a fungus that grows in grains that makes people go crazy for the most part. You will dance, you will hear voices, and they now say, most likely the Salem witch trials, the girls who were experiencing all of this weird psychotic stuff, most likely it was ergo poisoning.
It's like they're on hallucinogenics.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And so it really tracks these kind of historical points in history. It's a lot of chemical warfare going back to how people used to use plants to kind of infiltrate each other. It's just a really fascinating read, but it's very horror oriented. And it's been very inspirational after reading it. I'm like, oh, I should really do a movie about that or think about this. And so, yeah, it's just been really fun. But I highly recommend both of the books. I'm in the middle of Wicked Bugs right now. But Wicked Plants and Wicked Bugs by Amy Stewart. They have both been a trip.
Wicked. Excellent.
Cool. I got one more before we wrap up. You know, Elric mentioned this just randomly a couple episodes ago. And
It wasn't me. Somebody mentioned it and I said it was Parigi. I can't remember who mentioned it.
It came up on an episode and it made me want to revisit it. And it's a movie from 2003 called Love Object. It was written and directed by Robert Parigi.
Oh, I think Ryan mentioned the actor.
Yeah, we were talking about the actor.
Oh, yeah. And so anyway, you put it in my head and I was like, you know what? I want to watch that movie again because it's been a really long time. And Robert Parigi is a good friend of ours. He was on Killer POV way back, episode 112 of Killer POV, which
you can
find on
YouTube. One of the smartest guys you
will meet. Yeah, he's
sharpest, smartest.
What's the show that he's on now?
He did produce Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
He was
one of the producers on that. But this is his writer directorial debut, and Lionsgate put this out on DVD. And it's just really interesting. It's Desmond Harrington, who before Dexter, it was actually probably around Wrong Turn time because he was in the first Wrong Turn. And basically he – and his next door neighbor is Udo Kier because, of course, you need weird next door neighbor. And basically he's just kind of he's like an analyst that breaks down like these reports of how things are made, like, you know, like a computer analyst at a job. And he's kind of like awkward and a little bit lonely. And basically he kind of has a crush on the girl that he works with, but simultaneously learns about this new life-size – I mean, sex doll, I guess that's the as quick
that's
as you
it
put
is.
It. And so he orders this thing. It costs like $10,000 and, you know, he's like, all right. And from there, it's just like I can't explain it. It's just it felt a little Lynchian to me too, in terms of like his obsession with not only this doll, but then how it kind of merges with reality, and he starts this relationship with this girl at work who happens to look exactly like the doll.
Is it the same actress? I can't recall.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's cool. That's a good
You know, and then, you know, and Rip Torn plays his, like, boss.
That's right.
His very aggressive boss. And, yeah, I mean, there's not much I want to say about it other than it's in that wheelhouse of, like, May. Mm-hmm. And more recently I watched Roman, which is kind of Angela Bettis' version of May. Mm-hmm. Just that whole, like, kind of creepy horror obsession with different characters.
Well, also they did a TV show on Sci-Fi or something for a while called – I think it was even called Love Object, and it was about people's strange love affairs with things.
Yeah,
and I saw one that was literally a guy with a doll like that, and it was – it creeped. I mean, because that was a real story, and it was so creepy.
Yeah,
and it makes sense. Some people are so isolated, and they want to transfer these feelings that are complex in relationships. You have to work at right versus I can just have this thing. And what I like about twists like this is they make that still complicated. It's not going to work out how you think it is.
Yeah, that's the thing. This isn't exactly. I wouldn't say like a scary horror movie in any sense. It's just got that underlining creepy vibe to it. And the thing that stands out to me is Desmond Harrington, like, goes for it. Mm-hmm. I love when you get an actor like this that 100% buys into the premise. I mean, because he's doing a lot of really, embarrassing things.
Yeah.
And he just goes for it. And you know, again, it makes me – I know, Parigi's gone on to do a lot of producing and television, but he's an interesting voice, and I hope he gets to make another feature.
Yeah.
This was Love Object's really cool. Still find it on DVD on Amazon, no problem. So
that's wonderful. Yeah. I love that movie. I'd love to see Parigi do more.
All-time favorite soundbite was going up to all these horror people at a convention to make a clip for one of those old shows I was doing, and it was like each person like, what's the first horror – or favorite horror monster, and everyone just had these one-liners. I asked him something about Frankenstein. He's just going, well, you know, it goes back to the Descartes myth, and he just starts going as it was like just asking the professor in the wrong moment to tell you their lecture on something. And I walked away going, okay, yeah, that guy knows something, a thing or two about
we need to have him back on the
especially
show,
especially about horror, because he's so good at that.
We need to do a doll episode at some point, because even just talking about this, it reminded me of the 1972 film Private Parts. Do you guys remember
that's Paul Bartel's first film, I believe.
It is
Paul Bartel,
that is Paul Bartel's first film. Yeah, I just remembered it because he was obsessed with a doll. He actually had a doll that he filled with water and slept with it and made it look like a girl. And
it's a midnight movie, yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. A midnight movie, but I need to rewatch it because it suddenly just brought it back.
It's on my DVR.
Ernie, you got that
like,
one?
Ernie's like, no, man.
No doll episode, man?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you don't like creepy dolls. So
Water-filled dolls. I'll make this really quick. I saw over the weekend a 1977 film called Rituals that just recently got re-released on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I know you've been talking about this one.
I know. And I finally saw, thanks to my friend Bill Neal, invited us over to his house to check it out with a group of people who had never seen it before. I think I came out a little cold on the film, and I'm still kind of processing it. Rob, have you ever seen this movie?
You and Rob. Yes. This started the letterbox war.
You were out when I talked about it, and he looked at my letterbox and immediately started getting
shit. Okay, so. So
I think I was expecting something else, and Deliverance.
I think, well, that's
kind of.
Bill did tell us, he was like, listen, this is kind of like the Canadian Deliverance. And I was like, okay, cool. I'm into that. I didn't know how Holbrook was in it, and I didn't know the premise of it. And it felt very dreamlike, the viewing experience, because it felt to me, Elric, like there was just like a lot of information that was being withheld, and I almost felt like I missed it.
Well, what's cool about this movie, and what could also put people off, is in the first like 30 minutes, it could become a very different film. There's a point where it's like, is this a cult thing, where there's a cult or a supernatural demonic thing happening? Like, there's all these weird clues and snakes.
I didn't get that vibe at all. I mean, like, I knew. What at first I really liked is just kind of like a setup. If you guys don't know, it's about a bunch of doctors who go off into the wilderness on a camping expedition. And you kind of get that Canadian flair of – that you kind of get from My Bloody Valentine, where you're just getting guys being guys and talking, you know, about stuff. Talking about life, love, you know, whatever.
And then things like shoes going missing.
Yes. Well, at first, you know, the shoes go missing, and then they're missing this, and then the trip just gets progressively worse as they go, and they realize that they're being stalked by someone. There's a pretty horrific reveal of what happens to one character when they wake up and they see like something with a spike. But again, I think it was just the filmmaking I was reacting to that just felt jarring to me. Like, there's a moment, this is not a spoiler, but they're crossing the river, And, you know, you're getting the sounds of the river rushing. You're listening to the guys talk. And all of a sudden, it just abruptly cuts underneath the river. And you see that there's a bear trap waiting for them underneath there. But it was just this weird juxtaposition of sound and visuals that just kind of threw me off. And I was like, wait a minute, what the fuck am I looking at under there? And it wasn't until they went back the second time I was like, oh, fuck, that's a bear trap.
Yeah.
Like some people gasped and caught it right away. It took me a minute. And it was like that delivery of information in the film. Maybe I was just sleepy. I don't know, but I just felt like I was missing things.
Do you think that it was intentionally done that way? Or?
Oh, no, absolutely.
I don't know how much other things this guy done. I know it's starring. You know, Hal Holbrook's incredible in it. Lawrence Dane, who would go on to direct Heavenly Bodies. But he was the bad guy in Scanners, is the other guy. You know, so one of them, not Ironside, but the other main guy.
Shit.
That's the other main guy.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
They're the two leads in that. And I think they're so good. I think the performances are so authentic and real in the same way as Deliverance. This is, you know, it's no Deliverance in the terms of like Deliverance's simplicity of that story about masculinities, but this I find this really dangerous. There's a parts where they're walking along at the cliff top taking one of the bodies and it feels dangerous. Even the filmmaking, you're like, holy shit, what are they doing?
No, and some of the covers that they got, like you said, when they're pulling, they're literally transporting a body upriver
and
they're
some
clinging
amazing stuff
to the cliff. And I was just like, Jesus,
it's a survivalist film at that point, and then you get a little bit of a Before Dawn taste towards the end.
Becomes more than that at the very end. And I don't know.
It's a lot of different movies. I will give it that, and I love Canadian exploitation. So, but there's something about this one that I haven't watched the Blu-ray, ironically, yet.
Who
even though it's sitting
the Blu-ray?
On my Code Red
Scorpion. Yeah.
But I think it's a worthwhile. I mean,
absolutely.
I love Deliverance too. So it's
if the kind of Deliverance knockoffs are your thing, and you like backwoods horror, go for it.
Yeah, and Holbrook's particularly.
Holbrook is very good.
Like, it's fun to see him as a lead too.
Yeah, there's a lot of great actors in it. But I'm still kind of processing. It's weird. You know,
he'll come
around. But Bill Neal, I salute you and thank you for showing me the movie.
Rituals.
Very cool.
Very cool. Okay, guys, we'll be back on the other side of this break.
This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers. Mixtape Massacre: Escape from Tall Oaks, the upcoming sequel to the cult favorite board game Mixtape Massacre, is now live on Kickstarter. But this time, the tables have turned. In this meta-cooperative game, players are placed in the shoes of Tall Oaks survivors, fighting off slashers, rescuing helpless residents, and safeguarding the town, all in an attempt to escape the maddening streets of Tall Oaks or die trying. Though working together at times, in the end, only one will be able to make their escape. Along with new mechanics, the fan-favorite killer scenes and bonus tracks are back, keeping the game retro fun and full of jokes and horror tropes. Own the original game, extend the town by combining both games, and turn your next game night into a slashers versus survivors party. Welcome back to Tall Oaks, now run like hell. Mixtape Massacre: Escape from Tall Oaks is currently live on Kickstarter until April 5th. Head on over to visittalloaks.com or mixtapemassacre.com to learn more and back the Kickstarter.
April 30th, Severin Films is swinging open the doors of the Insane Asylum and releasing killer Kiwi classic, Death Warmed Up, my favorite New Zealand title, from the standard definition prison it's been trapped inside for decades. This Blu-ray edition has been remastered by director David Blythe himself from the only existing elements and comes loaded with exclusive new special features. 3 years before Peter Jackson's bad taste, Death Warmed Up sprayed international movie screens with brains, blood, and bizarre body fluids for the first splatter movie in Kiwi history. A special edition with limited slip available for pre-order from www.severin-films.com and other April releases include Emmanuel and Francois Escape from a Woman's Prison and the Hemisphere Box of Horrors.
Out now from Exploitation Restoration Specials Vinegar Syndrome are four new Blu-ray sleaze classics. First, from the director of Logan's Run, Michael Anderson's atmospheric supernatural revenge film Dominique, starring Cliff Robertson. Plus, In the Cold of the Night, an off-the-wall proto-Skinamax jaw-dropper from the legendary cult filmmaker Nico Mastrakis, along with Francis Terry's gore-filled lo-fi creature feature The Suckling, in a never-before-seen restoration from its original negative. And finally, Andy Milligan's epic of urban debauchery, Flesh Pot on 42nd Street, presented fully uncut for the first time ever. Also out next month is a bloody and twist-filled giallo from acclaimed filmmaker Juan Antonio Bardem, The Corruption
of Chris Miller, an underseen masterpiece of early 70s Euro horror in a brand new 4K restoration and in its original scope framing for the first time on home video. Remember that Vinegar Syndrome might soon be in a city near you, from Cinema Wasteland to Monsterpalooza to Texas Frightmare, as well as plenty of other conventions and events. Be sure to visit vinegarsyndrome.com for exclusive deals, astounding sales, merch, and the latest and greatest in exploitation home video releases.
IFC Midnight brings the wind to theaters, iTunes, and VOD on April 5th. Babel, Eater of Bones, Ariok, Bringer of Vengeance, Mara, Dammer of Souls, There's Something Waiting Outside the Door. A demonic evil haunts the homestead in this chilling folklorish tale of madness, paranoia, and otherworldly terror. IFC Midnight is the leading distributor of genre entertainment in the U.S., responsible for modern-day classics like The Babadook, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and Ghost Stories. So be sure to check out The Wind, coming to theaters, iTunes, and VOD on April 5th. Hello, guys, and welcome back to Shockwaves. I am excited to introduce our guest tonight, Mr. Michael Fink.
Hello. Hi.
Michael.
Hi. Michael and I, we talked together at USC, and I had, up to that point, I've talked a lot with practical effects artists, but I'd never really, outside of the work I'd done in film, had sit-down conversations with a visual effects artist, and was so impressed by everything that Michael knew, and he has an Oscar. Is this our first Oscar-winning guest?
Possibly.
Possibly. Yeah. I think it might be.
Jordan Peele.
Jordan Peele.
Oh, wait. Yeah. Oh, wait. Yeah, well, but he had.
That was before.
That was before the Oscar.
You could tell.
But
you
know, even before the Oscar, I'd rate him a little higher.
But Mike has just a massive history going all the way back to Blade Runner. And
Star Trek.
Did you know a guy called Tom Southwell by any chance?
Very well. Yeah,
I teach with Tom Southwell. And
is that right?
Yeah, Steve's going. I know he did visual work on Blade Runner.
Oh yeah, he did. Did virtually all the graphics you see that stuck up on, stuck up on things.
It's
pasted on stuff. The little words
to create the world.
The sort of Asian writing. Uh-huh. I called it all technobabble. That was my name for it. I said, Tom, I need some technobabble. And he'd come up with these sheets. And back then it was Letraset. You know, there was no computer to do that. Mm. So it was great. It was great working with him. And I bump into him every couple of years.
Yeah, it's cool. But.
Well, I was going to read off some of the credits because, I mean, like a lot of these are just taking me back. It's Star Trek the Motion Picture, Blade Runner, War Games, Daryl. Remember Daryl?
Yeah.
Buckaroo Banzai.
I'm trying not to remember Daryl.
Anyone want to guess what Daryl stands for?
My Science Project.
Which we all geeked out about over email a couple of days ago.
I have to tell you that one summer I worked on three movies, briefly, sort of one was in post, one was shooting, and one was in prep.
Okay.
It was My Science Project,
here we go.
Weird Science, and
Real Genius.
And Real Genius.
Yeah.
And when they all came out at the same time, the review in the LA Times it reviewed all the movies at once, and it was called My Real Weird Science Project.
I mean, that trifecta just sticks with me. But the other one, The Blob, 88, Hunt for Red October, RoboCop 2, my personal favorite. Batman Returns.
Yeah. Which you were nominated for an Oscar on, right?
I want everyone at home to know that I just saw Ryan Turek scroll over Tango and Cash.
Yeah, man.
You do not scroll over Tango and Cash.
No, it's not supposed to be on there.
Oh, really?
Oh, see.
So you didn't work on
Ryan
Tango and Cash?
Are you looking at IMDb?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So you didn't work on Tango and Cash?
Oh, I did. Very much, yeah.
I love Tango.
But why is it not supposed to be on there?
Andrei Kirilenko, didn't he direct it?
Sure.
Okay. That's a good answer.
Man.
I will leave it at that.
Can I just – one Tango Cash story really quick.
Yeah.
It played at the New Beverly as part of a Stallone triple feature.
Oh.
And it was the middle – it was Cobra, Tango and Cash, and Cliffhanger.
Of course.
Yeah. Can I tell you
– an amazing trilogy.
The majority of the audience had not seen Tango Cash. It's one of my favorites.
It's so funny.
It was like
being – of those three, I think it might be the best.
Yes. It's
they're all fine.
I like it better than Cobra. But I got to tell you, not only was the audience insane, but like the last shot of that movie is literally Stallone and Russell like clapping hands and freeze framing, and it was like being at a rock concert. The whole audience erupted into applause and just loved it. Yeah. One of my favorite moments.
Well,
carry on.
Had we gotten to 13 Ghosts yet?
Well, that's, yeah, more contemporary films. You got Mars Attacks, X-Men, 13 Ghosts, The Mothman Prophecies, X-Men 2. I mean, it just goes on. Tron Legacy.
Yeah.
I fucking love Tron so much, yep. and I love Tron Legacy.
Oh, no, you're down a notch.
Sucker Punch, wow. Tree of Life. I mean,
Wait. Tree of Life. What did you do on Tree? Because obviously they had huge effects things. You had the dinosaurs. You were part of the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I was part of the dinosaurs.
And were you sitting in a room with Terrence Malick?
I acted out all their parts, and the animators did their job. No.
And Terrence Malick is directing you or something? Yeah.
Yeah. It was an interesting process.
But was that sitting with him, with what he wanted? Is he controlling
that?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, working on these, animating. If you watch the dinosaurs, they all overact. if you picture them as live characters, you'd say, I don't know who hired that guy.
They're that extra that's just being a little bit extra special.
But Terry had a particular view of what this was. A time when there were no cameras. So he felt what this had to be is some about 10 years before that film, I worked with Terry on some tests, and one of the tests he wanted to do was make a movie with a pinhole camera. And there are no pinhole motion picture cameras. And so we never got to do those tests. He went back to Texas for something and we never continued. But anyway, he wanted it to be a camera that just sort of found its way to back there in the Cretaceous period or whatever it was. And it had infinite depth of field as if it were a pinhole camera. Everything was sharp. Huh. And there was no camera operation. Cameras never moved. So we had this scene where a dinosaur spares the life of a carnivorous dinosaur spares the life of a herbivore. And then goes off and trots in the water to join his fellow carnivorous dinosaurs. And Terry and I were talking, and he said, "Well, he showed me they had previs of it." He said, "What do I do?" You know, I want to be able to sell that moment where this it's the moment where a dinosaur comes to consciousness and realizes that they have a choice. They don't have to just kill everything. So, how do I do that? And I said, well, you need to cut to the dinosaur. You need to see the dinosaur.
Yeah, just the static
all you have to do is like a little head tilt. You know, you don't need much, but you need some recognition. He said, no, I don't want to do that because that's not what the camera would do back then. You know,
camera back then.
Right. But, you know, he really was staying in that moment. And in that moment, that camera wouldn't have moved. It would have seen it all from these points of view.
Mm-hmm. But knowing him, I would have thought voiceover.
We really struggled and we had to sell the entire emotional and philosophical point with the dinosaur's foot over the little pterosaur. And we must have done 50 iterations. And the overall effects supervisor, a terrific guy named Dan Glass, who supervised all the effects in the film. There were moments when Dan and I would be working with the animators. He would come meet me up in Vancouver because that's where we were animating. And we'd get a shot out and he'd look at it and say, man, this is great. Terry's going to love this. This is terrific. And he'd show it to Terry and he'd go, no. And then we'd have to do it again. And it was a process. You found your way there.
I'm glad we talked about Terrence Malick on a horror podcast.
I know. We worked it in, guys.
We finally talked about Terrence Malick.
That was a win for Elric.
Well, we're going to back up because I know your backstory because we've co-taught a class together and I'm going to mess this up now that you just told me, you are the department chair for the film and television, and I work here and I can't even get the title out.
Production.
Division of Film and Television Production.
At USC.
I am.
Yes. And so we have co-taught a class together. So I've heard your backstory and it's fascinating. So we're going to go all the way back and start with, how did you first start getting into film? Like what piqued your interest at a young age?
Not much, actually. No, the first time I was on a movie set, I was 5 years old.
Because you're from L.A. originally.
I'm from
Van Nuys, right?
Yeah, I grew up in the Valley. Mm. I'm a Valley kid. I had a 57 Chevy two-door hardtop and cruised Van Nuys Boulevard.
Nice.
I did all those things. Yeah. So My dad had a business when I was a kid. My dad was a serial entrepreneur, and he consistently failed. He had one business that was successful, and this is the one. It lasted about 4 years, and then it wasn't successful anymore, and he went broke again. But anyway, we would go. He would take me to the set, and he made deals with Hollywood Cowboys in the years before there were agents and attorneys in the way. Anyway, I was 5 years old, and I just thought this was the best thing I'd ever seen. And everybody was so nice. You know, treated me nice, and Hopalong Cassidy gave me presents, and Roy Rogers gave me – everybody, you show up, and they would give you stuff. You know, so I thought that was good. That was the last time I was on a set until I got hired in December of 1977 to work on a film called The China Syndrome, which was originally called Eyewitness, actually. With Jane Fonda, Jack Lemmon, and Michael Douglas. Kind of a horror story in its own, with about a nuclear reactor meltdown. And I walked on the stage literally the first day, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I asked – the guy who hired me was one of my college roommates. And he called him and said, I got a job for you. And I said, when do you want me to start? And he said, tomorrow, 6 a.m. And it was about 3 in the afternoon. So I went in and I quit my job. And showed up at 6 and this thing. And I fell in love with it. I just was completely – I couldn't get it out of my mind. It was such an intense, collaborative, creative process. It was wonderful. Not a horror movie.
Yeah.
Sorry, but in a way it was. And that was my first job. And I lasted till we wrapped principal photography. So there was about 4 or 5 months. And it was about 6 weeks to we built a computer to simulate a nuclear reactor so that the actors on the set every time they flipped a switch and did certain things, the processes that a reactor would go through would happen just as it was real. And you didn't, and to reset, you just hit a button. You didn't have 20 or 30 special effects guys flipping switches and trying to get back to one. So we did that. It was really successful. Everything went great. And I went back to my studio. I was an artist. I graduated from CalArts with a degree in art. So I had my studio, and I was a starving artist. I went back to my studio, and I was bored, and I was lonely. I couldn't stand it. And I said, I got to go back to work. This is too much fun, a movie. And this was 1978 now. So, you know, in 1978, you raised your hand if you were anywhere good, anybody near good, or somebody might know your name or something, and say, hey, I'm ready. Anybody need me? And then somebody said, yeah, come on.
Wow.
And as long as there wasn't a strike, and 3 years later there was – 2 years later, it was a huge strike, you could get a job. So I went to work at Doug Trumbull's facility in Glencoe, and they had
– Silent Running?
What's that?
You made Silent Running?
Doug made Silent Running.
Yeah, I just watched that a couple days ago again.
And Brainstorm.
Yep, Brainstorm.
Oh, gosh.
And won the Oscar for 2001, The Effects of 2001.
No.
Oh, didn't he?
No, 2001, I don't think. Did it win?
I think, yeah. Yeah, what, that's the only Oscar it won was the special effects.
I kind of don't think he was named.
Oh, okay. For some reason.
It was weird because he should have been if he was not. And I could be wrong because I'm not.
You should know better than me, though.
I should.
I will defer to you either way.
But you know, I'm very old and I'm given. You have to cut me some slack.
Yeah, that's okay. I think that's fair. I'm going to grill you, man.
Okay. I was going to say, I just want to take a quick moment for a second because you talked about China Syndrome, and I looked up the original poster because it scared the shit out of me because I didn't know. I mean, like, it was before my time, but the poster is sold as a horror movie, and it says, people who know the meaning of the China Syndrome are scared. Soon you will know.
That's such like a 1970s like end of the world apocalypse.
Yeah, that's the picture.
Oh, that's a great poster. Yeah.
It's not as scary as the crew jacket for War Games.
What was on the crew jacket for War Games?
Well, back then, crew jackets were satin, right? They were satin baseball jackets, and they were embroidered with shit.
Yeah. I try to buy them on eBay all the time.
Yeah, those things go for so expensive. Yeah.
Really?
They were so
I have boxes under my house filled with
– Dude, that's
have
like –
at it, man.
Well, there's four people here that'll take some of them
off their
hands.
That's a vacation right there,
so
man.
The War Games jacket, it was designed by John Badham, and I love John Badham, we're friends, and he's a terrific guy, and I love working with him. I did a couple of pictures, three pictures with him.
You didn't do the one with the helicopter though, right?
Blue Thunder.
I mean, that's I watched it recently, and I was like, this is the craziest movie ever filmed.
No.
Because you're around L.A. flying these helicopters. It's insane.
Yeah, but they really were, too.
I know. It looks wild. Yeah.
No, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But anyway, where was I?
The jacket.
Sorry, jacket for War Games.
Yeah. So
we're getting toward the end of the production, and his assistant, a young woman named Dana, she was really terrific. And Dana said, "Mike, we just got the sample of the copy for the crew jacket. You want to see it?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And she holds this thing up, and on the front they embroider your name and War Games, and on the back, there was a mushroom cloud with a happy face.
Wow.
And I looked at that and said, "Dana, you're not serious. You're not going to put a happy face mushroom cloud on the back of these jackets." "Oh, yeah, we already made the order." So I have one.
That's awesome.
And it's also – it was gray. It was all metallic colors, you know, satiny. So it was gray, red, white, and black in different panels. I mean, it was –
That's incredible.
If Waldo wore it, you could find him.
Yeah. All right. So we went on a tangent.
Yeah, we were
Doug Trumbull.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. You were with him.
Yeah. So what are we talking about, Doug Trumbull?
Well, how did you transition? So you were doing.
Oh, because I worked on Star Trek.
Yeah. How did you transition from doing the actual, like, you were making that device on set to working more in the visual realm, more digitally?
When I went to work over at Trumbull's facility, it was Trumbull's facility, but basically Universal was in production on Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. They four-walled the miniature crew. They had hired originally John Dykstra and his crew at Apogee to do the effects on Galactica, and that didn't work out. And I don't know why. I was building stuff and wiring light bulbs. I don't know. So I got this job and didn't even know what I was going to be working on. And they said, "Well, we're only going to be in this building another week. We're moving to North Hollywood where the Universal has a facility, and we're going to build out this facility and do visual effects." Then they found out I knew a few things about – little things about electricity, especially high voltage stuff. Mm-hmm. And we had to develop ways to hide model movers and camera movers and things that went in front of the blue screen. So you'd have a blue screen. And then it had a miniature spaceship, and then it was on a pylon that was computer controlled so it could look like it was flying. But the pylon would be in the film, and you couldn't have that, so you had to get rid of it. And so I just developed ways to enclose the pylon in a blue thing that matched exactly the spectrum of the blue screen. And this is photochemical days, so it really had to be right. And there was a lot of art to it. It wasn't so much technology. It was a lot of art. So I had a great time. It was really a lot of fun. But in the process of doing that, I had to work with the optical guys. Mm-hmm. And so I would shoot tests, and then we'd take them into opticals, and then they would try to extract mats and see how the mats looked and give me tips on maybe if you could fix this, that would be better, and how do we do that? And I could talk to the camera guys, and maybe if we use a polarizer, we could probably get rid of that reflection in the bottom of the ship. And so we did that. And so I started to learn about optical effects. And at the same time, I was drowning in toxic chemicals from making all these armatures and things that had to be done out of epoxy and resin. And I was really not – it wasn't good. This is in the days before – no mass, no ventilation, no nothing. Talk about a horror show. I mean, it was rough. And so I said, I got to find another way. And I was good at making lights blink. And so I kind of started working making lights blink on shows, basically. And there were two guys at Universal Heartland, this facility, who were the effects supervisors. I never knew there was such a person. And they were there running the show. And I thought, man, that's a great job. I love that job. It's like uses all of your art stuff, all your management abilities. And I was an officer in the Army. I was a money manager in San Francisco before that. You know, I had a few lives. Mm-hmm. So I thought, this is just terrific. I love this. So I started sort of angling toward that. And then I got hired on Blade Runner. Finished Blade Runner, was collecting unemployment, looking for a gig, got a friend, call from a friend of mine who was an art director on War Games. Mm-hmm. And he just said, "Why don't you come by for lunch? I just want to show you what we're doing. It's so cool." And so I went over there for lunch, And he showed me all the drawings and the designs for the sets, and they were way early in prep, so there was nothing but just some design. And I thought, that looks really cool. And they called a meeting, and I went into the meeting, and they said, come on, Mike, you know, come on in the meeting and sit down with us. So, and they started talking about these things, and they didn't know what they were called. And I said, well, what they're called is enunciators. And I'd learned that from China Syndrome.
Ah.
Yeah. 6 weeks before China Syndrome, I didn't know anything. And so they said, you know the name of that? And I said, yeah. And I said, oh, that's cool. Okay. Now we know what to call them. So we talked. I went home. I had a great time. I was there for a few hours. I went home. Next day I woke up and I said, gee, what am I going to do today? I ain't going to go back to War Games. So I went back, and it was a very tiny crew. It was the art department, the director, producer, a couple of producers, and nobody else. And so I started going to meetings and hanging out there. And then I found a desk with a phone, right? So I started just going and sitting at the desk, and people would start asking me to do stuff. Mike, do you know anything about how to – projectors? And can we talk to you about, you know, that kind of stuff? And 3 weeks later, I was in a meeting, and the producer, the line producer, looked at me and said, are we paying you? And I said, no. And he said, oh, we got to fix that. And I walked in his office. We made a deal. And he said, what do we call you? And I said, well, what you're asking me to do is what a visual effects supervisor does. So if you called me visual effects supervisor, that'd be fine. He said, okay.
Wow.
So that was
defining your job.
That was my first. And that line producer was a guy named Harold Schneider, who's gone now, mm-hmm. Who was an absolutely insanely wonderful guy. And insanely goes with the wonderful. He was a total nut. But he was just terrific.
What was your – because you skipped over it so quick. What was your role on Blade Runner before that? What was your particular task that you had to get done?
Well, because I built – I had this reputation for building interfaces. Mm. I mean, just things that actors had to
– like computer screens, like when he's typing, doing the test on
or
the –
or like on Star Trek, where they have to interact with the consoles, I'm guessing.
You have to, yeah, but it was – let's see. I mean, you can go way back to the stuff on China Syndrome. Mm-hmm. All those knobs and dials and switches and stuff, they left that up to me. You put them where you think they need to be. You make sure the actors – know which ones to use, the other one, because there are a lot of dummies in there. And, you know, do that. So I was constantly building things that people had to interface with. Hmm. And they had a few props like that in Blade Runner.
Yeah.
So they called around, and I had worked with Doug on Star Trek, and Doug was doing the effects for Blade Runner, and Doug said, you should call Mike Fink. And I was on a picture called One from the Heart for Francis Coppola.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we were done. With me, we were done. I mean, the crew, parts of the crew needed to stay behind, but I was finished with my work. So I took the job. And I said, I don't know what I'm doing. They said, all you're going to have to do, you're not going to be here very long. All you have to do is the interior of the flying police car.
Oh, cool.
The spinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay. And did they have designs? Yeah, but they weren't. Yeah, problems. I got there. I was there for a few days. I didn't have a crew yet. Larry Paul, the production designer, also a good friend, called me and said, what are you doing this evening? I need you to come to a meeting. We're in a crisis mode. We don't have a VoIP-conf machine. This is Thursday night. It shoots Tuesday morning. We need you. Come to the meeting. So I went to the meeting. I saw this absolutely embarrassingly bad prop. Mm. By a group of guys who got paid way too much money to put something together in a few days. I don't know. You know, it was back in the cocaine days.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's what they were doing because I don't really know. I didn't know them. But we sat in a room with the guys who built it and the whole art department and all the producers. Ridley was not there. And they finally looked at me and said, what do we do? And I said, look, I went to art school. When I went to art school, you had to learn – if you're going to draw a figure, you kind of had to understand the skeleton of a human being before you could draw that figure. And if you understood that, you could actually draw pretty good characters, even abstract characters, if you really understood what you could then divert from. You know, you make it. I said, because they kept saying, the other team that built this thing, they said, give us 24 hours. We can fix it. We can fix it. And I said, this can't be fixed in 24 hours. I'm sorry, guys, but you can't do it. It's not – There's nothing about it that works, and nothing looks good. And it's not a 24-hour job. And so then they said, what do we do? And I said, let me call my friend Mark Stetson. So I called Mark Stetson, who he and I became friends on Star Trek. And Mark was the miniature shop guy on Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. But he was just getting his crew together. They are just getting started. I said, I need you and your entire team from tomorrow morning until Tuesday morning, around the clock. And he checked with his boss, who's Richard Jurasich, and Richard said, yeah, sure, do it. So we jumped in there Friday morning, and we did the Voight Kampff machine in 4 days. I delivered it to the set on Tuesday morning. Mark and I were the last two people standing. Everybody else had collapsed. I was hallucinating like crazy. And I got to the set, and I took the Voight Kampff out of a cardboard box, and I set it on the table, and Ridley saw it, and he said, fucking terrific.
Nice.
And I thought, okay, okay. I think it's worth all those sleepless
nights. Yeah,
that's great.
So that's the machine in the movie. Yeah. Not always. There's another machine in the movie, which they didn't get all the coverage on the machine they wanted, and they went and they shot it again in London, but the monitors needed to be PAL in London, and they were NTSC here, U.S. standard, and they had to replace the monitors, and they kind of changed it a bit.
Pretty important scene in the movie.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Pretty key.
Yeah, and the little bellows, that was my contribution was the bellows.
Oh, cool.
Beyond that, I just ran the crew. So. And that's what I did then for like 6 months on the movie. Just Larry would call me up and say, we need elevator lights. We forgot to get elevator lights. How quickly can you get elevator lights down here to the Bradbury building? And I go, hour and a half. He'd say, okay. And I design something. We put it together. So I was an art director, really, on that movie. And that's why they called me action prop supervisor, because I wasn't in the local. I wasn't a union guy.
Right. So
then you started transitioning into doing more computer-based stuff eventually, correct?
Right about then. Yeah.
Wow. And so I'm going to jump forward just a little bit. So I want to get into some. So we're looking, I guess, around mid, late 80s. When was The Blob? That would have been later.
The Blob was 88.
Yeah. So we have had Tony Gardner on before, and he talked about the practical effects of it and how he created the blob out of fabric, wasn't it?
Well, like that was part gelatin.
Part of what he was part gelatin, like part silk fabric. And yeah.
Oh, my God.
So
you hired Tony, is that correct?
He was already there.
Oh, he was already there.
But he was sort of a minion. He was just like one. Another guy there is a guy named Bill Corso, who you may know.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept Bill and Tony. And the rest of the crew, except for the puppeteers, had to go away because they were Lyle's folks, and they really were married to doing stuff that we couldn't do.
Right.
And so they came, and then we kind of repopulated real quickly. So the fabric blob was actually designed by Lyle, and he built it. And the full-size blob – mm-hmm. Weighed 700 pounds.
Are you serious? What was it made of?
Water.
So it was like a balloon?
It was like a big waterbed, but it wasn't. It was silk or satin or some kind of diaphanous material, painstakingly airbrushed with veins and coloration through. It was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. And then we had seamsters, mm-hmm. who would stitch it all together into these quilts. And then we would pump methyl cellulose. Mm. Do you guys know what methyl cellulose is?
Not a clue.
McDonald's uses it to make sure their milkshakes never melt.
Yep.
Oh. It's a thickener.
Gross.
Oh, weird.
Drink it up.
And it's a dietary – it's cellulose. You can eat it because it's just like eating ground up wood fiber. Not exactly nutritious, but you can put it in a milkshake and it's legal. We bought methyl cellulose. You buy it dry, and then you add water to it. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely a nightmare to work with. And so these things were unbelievably slippery and slidey. And to puppet them, you put puppeteers under this thing. So imagine crawling under a waterbed and then trying to move and lift and push. And so it was – and communicate with – you're going – they don't even know what direction they're going,
How did you keep it from crushing them? I'm picturing 700.
Oh no,
pounds.
It didn't. It's like spread out over this whole thing. So each person had 75 pounds or something to move, you know, because you have a lot of people under there. Yeah. For the big ones. We had built miniature ones, too, because there's all those miniature shots.
Right. Mm-hmm. With the ice truck and all the
yeah, van there's and all that yeah. stuff. The yeah. city, that street, when mm-hmm. the blob was on the street, that yeah. whole thing is miniature. And that was – originally it was going to be one stage with one crew building everything, but they were so far behind. And we expanded to three stages. I supervised and directed one stage. Hoyt Yateman supervised and directed another stage. And Alex Funke, who shot all the miniatures for Lord of the Rings, and among others, and a few Academy Awards in there, Alex ran the other stage. Mm. And we also had a bunch of – Chuck Schumann, who's a terrific effects DP, was with us. And we shot all the miniature stuff for the blob. Mm-hmm. But – because it had already been shot and they had scenes with Lyle's blob,
right.
we had to stay with Lyle's blob. But it took the crew to show up to manage the blob as soon as we had a call sheet and it said the blob works tomorrow. Then the blob crew had to stop working on making blobs and go to the set and work all day puppeting blobs. So then all the work stopped in the room because they didn't hire enough people. And so they all had to do that. There was just so many problems. So it was really – that's why I think my credit is visual effects production supervisor. I don't – because I didn't produce it and I didn't – I wasn't the visual effects supervisor. But I – you know, Hoyt Yateman and I and his partners at DreamQuest were doing all those miniature effects. And they were all my friends from working with Doug. I had met them all at Doug Trumbull's place. So from Star Trek. So we worked it out and we got it all done. And we wound up with 80 puppeteers.
Oh, my gosh.
And some of the shots were shot reverse action, upside down sets. And the blob, if you took a blob, you know, they say, okay, cut and relax. And then you took the quilt, even if it was just a small one. Because it was just kind of like coming out of vent or coming through the thing. My favorite shot in the movie is the guy who gets pulled through the bookcase.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
do you
yeah.
remember that guy?
Yep. He gets his back broken.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
I like the drain. The drain is amazing.
Oh, the drain
person getting
is
sucked
cute.
Into the drain.
Oh,
right? It's just such a
I always love the phone booth.
Yeah, phone booth's amazing.
They walk past
shot,
the
yeah.
phone booth and it's just
is that
gorgeous.
Candy Clark, I think?
Yeah.
It's great.
The one I always laugh at is when the blob slaps down on the street and peels the guy off. There's like a guy yeah. running, it yeah. slaps down, and then he just peels back and the guy's like stuck to the blob.
Yeah. So the crew actually made a puppet of me and put it in the movie theater.
Oh, really?
So the blob in the movie theater is coming over the seats yeah. and engulfs me.
Oh, my God.
That's amazing. Awesome.
Nobody knows. You can't tell.
Well, you before off air, you were telling us you were watching the original blob in theaters with your friends. So that's – I love that journey, you know.
Yeah. It's wonderful having, you know, done those kinds of things. I really had a great time. I had a great time with Chuck Russell, who directed it. I had, you know, terrific time with the crew. But it was really hard because I had to keep going back to the bank and saying to Rupert, we need more money.
Yeah.
And I really didn't want to do that. But he told me what their budget was when he hired me and how much they'd already spent. And I said, you don't have enough money. You don't have any of these shots. None of the stuff is done. It's not ready. They had to keep moving the shooting schedule and shoot around the blob. And the movie's called The Blob. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we caught up. They got finished. They finished on time. The AD was Josh McLaughlin, who's pretty famous in his own right. You know, Avatar and Titanic and Real Steel and a million other movies. Mm-hmm. And Constantine with me as well. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Now, when did you notice that effects started really transitioning from the practical stuff that you were doing on the blob like that to more computer-based? Like, was there a specific film where you were kind of like, oh, this is different?
Yeah, it started in the mid-'80s. And I was on a show for 6 weeks, which had its plug pulled. So that was as long as it went. Never got paid. Really great.
Oh.
Can you say what movie it was?
It was called – it had a kind of working title of Gizmo. Hmm. And it was about a guy who inherits the house. His brother dies. And he goes to the house, and the house is an intelligent house. His brother was a computer scientist
and
had wired the house to be this intelligent house
and also had downloaded
his entire intellect into this house.
Wow.
I would have watched this movie.
Oh, I love the script.
Yeah.
The script was great. The director was going to be Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah. Whoa.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was having so much fun with Richard. It was great.
Huh.
And we had to come up with all these images on screens that was going to be his brother's face. Hmm. And I said to Richard, I think what you really want – because he was going to be the brother that survived, mm-hmm. right? So I said, wouldn't you want to have your actor really there when you're speaking to him on the screen and looking all computery, you know? But so I started getting into what's it going to take to make a computer face in 1985.
Huh.
And there was really only one way to do it, which was sort of fake, mm-hmm. you know. It was pointing a video camera at the guy and image processing it in real time and then rendering it out. And then I found this glass. If an image is presented on the back surface of the glass, it translates to the front surface of the glass. So there's no parallax. It's not like you're looking through a thick piece of glass. The image is right on the front so that it's always the same luminance so the DP can shoot it from any angle. Mm-hmm. And it looks really cool because nobody had a screen that looked like that. And it was supposed to be a computer screen, but the image was really present right out in front. And that's as far as I got in six weeks. But we were talking about doing – there was supposed to be some sentient being stuff. And I talked to John Whitney Jr. and an old friend who's – oddly enough, I just blanked on his name. But it'll come back in a second. We talked about actually doing motion capture in 1985 and trying to get in. I abandoned it because I knew it was never going to work in time. And then I was off the show. So that was, you know, but all of us were doing this. We're trying to figure out how to make images digital, how to scan them from film, how to input them into the computer, how to move the data, because there was no pipeline for that. There was nothing. And there's no way to play anything back. There's nothing. So we started there. Then about 1989, things really started to warm up, 88, 89. And I did for a feature film. Before that, I did some tests for John Badham for Bird on a Wire. Mm-hmm. And he decided he wanted to go with the hand animated stuff instead of the – I think he was afraid we may not make the date. And he was right. He made a good decision. Mm. I don't think we would have. I think – we would have died. But it really looked cool. And so he went with the hand animated stuff and he could rely on. But then by 89, things started to be happening and alpha channels had been invented and shaders that could round things off and make surfaces look smooth and shiny and stuff. So there were things that were happening. You know, all these guys, Alvy Ray Smith and Turner Whitted and Ed Catmull and all these guys who were computer scientists were doing wonderful stuff, but it was really laboratory stuff. But the film industry was pushing so hard for this, and we were all pushing so hard because we wanted to abandon opticals because opticals were so out of control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could get a perfect composite, perfect. Everything was great, but on frame 200 – there was a hair or a piece of dirt or a scratch, and it couldn't be final. It couldn't go in the movie. So you'd have to recomp it. You recomp it, it would fall apart. You couldn't get the same result again. It'd never be good again. And then you'd scratch an element. And then you had to make it over again. And then you had to do something. I dreaded opticals every time. And we did some pretty nice work on the movies I worked on. But, it's rough. So 88, 89 – started to do stuff on Tango and Cash. I did a digital wire removal shot. I took it to ILM. It was 72 frames. It cost $16,000.
To remove wires?
To remove two wires against a bald sky.
Ugh.
I could do this at home in like 5 minutes.
I think my students can do that now.
Yes, right. They can do it. Yeah. It's not crazy. But that's what it costs. But in the process of doing that shot, we discovered a problem with film stock that we had never noticed before. And then that led to Hoyt Yeatman doing a whole investigation and going to Kodak and say, you have to fix this. And Kodak completely revised the way they made their film stocks to fix this artifact that we could see digitally and then was winding up in the films that disappeared when you did opticals because the opticals were never good enough. So it didn't matter. So we started getting – and then, you know, when I did Batman Returns, at the beginning of Batman Returns, I figured about 20% of the movie was going to have some digital component. Mm-hmm. By the time we finished the movie, 18 months later, 80% of the movie and visual effects had digital stuff in it. And we had – the penguins were supposed to be stop-motion puppets. That's how I started out. But a couple of months in and I wanted to do some tests and I was working with the guys at Boss and I was working with with Richard Hollander at what was then called VIFX. Mm-hmm. Richard just finished Battle Angel and now he's on Avatar.
Oh, wow.
What he's doing next. We actually worked on China Syndrome. We worked on our first movie together. We've been friends forever.
That's cool.
So anyway, the transition really happened from 1990, roughly, when I got hired on Batman, to 1992, 93. Right. Because in Batman, we had penguins and bats that were digitally built and animated and sometimes composited, but quite often because compositing uses huge amounts of memory and files and data transfers are difficult, we would have to render each element, put it out to film, and then composite it photochemically, which mm-hmm. just drove me crazy. But at least the mats fit. That was a good thing because we had to render those too. Right. Anyway, so that all worked. It just went – it flipped. From 91, 92, yeah. It just flipped. And then right after that was Jurassic Park.
Right.
And there was also Back to the Future.
Well, there was T2 as well.
And T2.
And I remember The Abyss was always a milestone moment.
Yeah. Abyss was 89.
Yeah.
So it was the pseudopod in Abyss.
Yeah.
And they tried everything to make a pseudopod.
Before, did they really?
Before they finally got to the – there was a little crazy team of CG guys who were working on it. And finally showed it to people and said, look, this we can do this.
Right.
And they went, hey. Okay. If you look at it now, it's you could be so much better.
Sure.
But it totally works.
Well, I'm really curious to see Abyss. Apparently they're cleaning it up and doing a proper 4K Blu-ray release or something like that.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Somebody had taken a photo at some transfer lab or something, and it was like, it's happening. And it was like, hashtag the abyss, hashtag Blu-ray. I was like, okay. Yeah. Well,
you didn't see the Twitter thing with James Cameron?
No.
Ryan Johnson, the director of Last Jedi, tweeted something about, I can't find True Lies digitally.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds replied, try the abyss. And James Cameron replied to both of them saying, guys, I'm working on it. This is like the last two days.
That's, really funny. Like kind of purposely holding out for
those. Ryan is a USC graduate, right?
Who's that?
The guy who did The Last Jedi. I'm pretty sure he's a USC graduate.
Yes.
So as things changed, where I find it most interesting from the horror perspective is how you start doing some of the more creature-y stuff.
Right.
Like someone like Constantine or 13 Ghosts, they come at you and they say, okay, it's got demons. How do you start creating them on a computer and determining like what they're going to look like?
In the old days?
We'll say in the 90s when those films were coming to fruition.
Early 2000s.
Early 2000s, yeah.
Yeah. Constantine was in – I started that in 2003, mm-hmm. right after X-Men 2. Yeah. And I wanted to do the movie because it shot in L.A. and nothing shot in L.A. So it was like, wow, I could stay home for a year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's great. But also I liked the script and I loved working with Francis Lawrence. I'd do that experience again any day. So we had creatures in that, and that was 2003. We were designing creatures, and we were working with Stan Winston. Stan was alive at the time, and his crew, all the guys at Legacy Effects, Shane Mann and John Rosengrant. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the guy whose name I couldn't remember was Mike Warman, Warman.
Good job.
I remembered that. it was kind of a pretty – it was like doing any kind of construction job, mm-hmm. you know. But in 2003, building a muscle system and fat and all the kinds of things you needed to make a creature feel alive barely existed. Mm-hmm. It really didn't. You just had blend shapes and shape deformations and, you know, if an arm went like that, the bicep didn't form unless you animated it to mm-hmm. form. You know, there was no muscle system to make that work. They were just – that kind of stuff was just coming into it and being practical. So – and lighting was in its infancy really, even though it had been around. We've been doing CG stuff since the late 80s that was in feature films. The lighting was always difficult. The lighting on the penguins in Batman Returns is abysmal. Pardon me for the abyss thing. But it was terrible. They looked awful. You look at that movie now, they're like, oh, my God, how did these get in the movie? But we really didn't have another way to do those shots. Mm-hmm. And that was the best lighting we could render at the time in 1991 or whatever. So anyway, so that's that. If you're asking me, you know, how did we do those first things, it's the same process that you go through with anything. You design the creature, figure out what you want it to look like. Francis had some images from old books and other stuff that he wanted, so we came up with these demons from hell and the Seplevites, which were the flying things mm-hmm. that didn't have any legs. Mm-hmm. I think the no legs part was my idea. I went on a location scout to Yugoslavia. And I went to a bar with my hand. This is back when Yugoslavia was Yugoslavia. Mm. And my handler took me to a bar. And he said, have you ever had Shlivovitz? I said, no. So he says, I'm going to order some. So he orders Shlivovitz. And they bring it in a little tulip-shaped stem glass. But they break the stem off. So you have to drink the Shlivovitz. You can't put the glass down. Because wow. It has no bottom.
Yeah.
Right? And I saw these little concept sets for the Seplevites, and I said to Francis, what if they just have to fly constantly? They can never rest because they have no place to rest on. Right. They'll just fall flat on their face. And so we did that.
That's a great lesson of connecting ideas. I love that, yeah.
What, tell us about the 13 Ghosts experience.
Yeah, that was a while back too. That was 2001.
2001.
Well, 2000, 2001. Yeah. We actually were finishing the film when 9/11 happened. Mm. So, yeah. And we were working on some of the bloodiest shots. And I couldn't work on them.
Yeah.
I couldn't work on them. The crew couldn't work on them. We had to, like, step away for a few days and come back and regroup.
Right.
Figure out. And I talked to Joel Silver about, Joel, this is going to be difficult.
Yeah.
You know, and he's Joel, you know. What? It's going to be difficult. Just take care of it. And we did.
Yeah.
But 13 Ghosts. The facility that was working on the film was up in Alameda. Mm-hmm. It was the facility that had done the first Matrix. And it was then, I can't remember, I can't remember what their name was. They became ETC. Mm-hmm. ESC, excuse me, the escape button on a computer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Joel Hynek was up there and a bunch of really bright people up there. So, God damn it, I lost my track of that.
We were on 13 Ghosts.
Yeah, 13 Ghosts. Yeah. So, anyway, it was up there, and Warner Brothers, this is. They were, I guess, about to move to Alameda or something. I can't remember. Warner Brothers shut the facility down just like that. Mm. And they couldn't work on the movie. So Dan Glass, the guy who was the supervisor on Tree of Life, called and said, do you think you guys can do this? And I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure we can. I was at CineSite at the time. So he called and he came down. We met a lot. The pipeline that they had, the pipeline we had were totally different. Totally different. And so there was a lot of rigging. And the director was a really good guy, really knew what he was doing. Nice guy, but the schedule was insane. And we just inherited all these shots. Now, luckily, Dan is a really good supervisor, so almost everything he shot was perfect. We didn't have to fix things. There was just no fixing. Right. There were a couple of shots where we had to kind of do a little dance to make them work, but it was pretty easy. So for us, it was really design work. That house that did all that stuff didn't really exist. Right. It was just the front porch and an area around the door.
Yeah, I was curious about that because it was just like that was the whole thing. It was a glass house.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's all with CG. All the writing everywhere. So the house, none of that actually exists.
Some of it did. Yeah. Some of it did. When it's not moving, some of that was a set. Right. But when it starts animating and panels are sliding in and out, some was practical because there were real reasons for it to be practical with the actors. Right. Mm-hmm. When that girl is getting squeezed between the glass, it's practical up to the point where she would actually be in danger. And then the glass comes together and we took her and squished her in digitally.
Yeah. Lucas had the split, the lawyer.
Glass comes down.
Yeah, the glass comes down
cuts
on
a guy
him.
In half. Yeah.
He slides. Yeah.
Yeah. So we had to do that. We had to do, all the demons around that big whirligig thing and jumping through.
The movie's nuts. Then,
I love that movie. Any movie with a character called the Juggernaut. I'm just in.
Right, right. So it was kind of insane. The schedule was insane. It was really okay. It was fun. Dan was left the show. He was no longer the supervisor and went to work on The Matrix, the new Matrix films. Because Joel is producing those too, and Joel wanted Dan on The Matrix, so he took them off and they left it with me and the guys at Cinesite. So we built all those machines, we did all that stuff, we sliced and diced people, we'd splatter, we had when F. Murray Abraham gets caught in the machine and his head flies out toward the camera. That's the shot that about maybe 15% of the crew was working on when 9/11 happened.
Oh my gosh.
And that one went on the shelf for a while.
Yeah.
So there were, some shots we could approach pretty nicely and others not. And that was it. I mean, it's not it was post-production, so not a lot of glamour, right? It was a lot of fun. I'm disappointed in some of the work we did. I wish we could have done better had there been more time. Mm-hmm. I think we would have done it. There was one point when Dan stopped by and he said, gee, it'd be really wonderful. We had some self-reflections on the interior of that machine. And I said, yeah, wouldn't it? He understood. It was like there was no time.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So that was it. And the creatures were great. Mm-hmm.
Such a fun movie.
Where do you fall now? And I guess a lot of us are often nostalgic for Men in Suits, almost, because you just we've moved so far away from that. Where do you fall in the – I often kind of think, I love a practical effect, but then I love digital to kind of finish it and kind of complete mm-hmm. that effect versus replace it entirely. Mm-hmm. How do you – as somebody who's – I think it's kind of rare to have somebody who started in one avenue and ended in the other. How do you feel about when you see movies now, the difference between just straight replacement where everything is CG versus having a mixture of the two?
Well, I still prefer the mixture of the two. Mm. Constantine, even though it's a while back now, is pretty good example of the kind of stuff I like to do. When Keanu Reeves runs through the building chasing Rachel Weisz, is being carried away by this demon and invisible person, character, whatever force, and flown, captured, and he's chasing her, and the walls are blowing through, and if you remember all that stuff, we did. Keanu running through blue holes in the place. Then we had Keanu run through it, but we filmed the holes blowing. Then we had him run through it, and then I put the two together with a lot of CG enhancement to the blowing. When the elevator doors yank back and Rachel goes flying back at the very beginning of that, the elevator doors going open are real. Hmm. And the next layer, the other side of the elevator shaft breaking open, that's real. But we also augmented it later. There's a lot of stuff like that. And I try to put that in every movie because it really grounds the work. Yeah. And the CG artists do a much better job. Mm-hmm. They really aren't trying to invent everything. It's really hard to do everything.
And is that when they do try to push it so it's just CGI, is that just generally you think a producer trying to save on some other side of the equation? Because I would imagine that's also expensive to – all the CG work has to be pricey too, right?
Yeah, it is, but there's far less CG work than you'd have to do otherwise.
Right.
So you're saving there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a problem with large visual effects films. There's a line producer. The line producer is generally on until the end of principal photography. Then they leave. So they're concerned with the budget for the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
They want to make their days, and they want everything to come in on budget. And if that means screwing the visual effects and letting that fall into post, that's fine with them. And they're not mean, bad people. They're just trying to stay on budget. Mm-hmm. They're doing their job. So they do their job, and we do our job. And if you have a good team, if I have a good producer with me and I'm doing my job and she or he's doing her job or his job, we'll be fine.
Mm.
And we get it worked out. But you have to do it. The scene in Constantine where Keanu runs on the freeway trying to escape the demons, we built a freeway on a stage at Warner Brothers, just about 200 feet long and narrower than most freeways, and maybe 100 feet wide. We scanned it. We laid on LiDAR, scanned it. We photographed the crap out of it, and we extended it digitally, and we had models for everything so we could project the freeway back on the models to make sure that it was all right. But Keanu, as an actor, really needed to know he was on a freeway and to know where all those busted up cars were and to know where to have him jump up on a – actors bring an awful lot to a film. They're so inventive and they think about things. But if you really put them in just the class that Rebecca and I taught together, and I still teach it, if you put them in just a complete blue or green environment and say, do your thing, they get lost. Their heads explode. And directors have their heads explode too. So I really try to keep that stuff in there. And I, after Constantine was – Golden Compass, I guess. There was something in between there for a little bit. Oh, yeah, Jumper for a very short period. And then and it's the same thing. I try to plan it. Sometimes you can't, and sometimes people say, why did you try to do it practically when you're now going to have to redo it all? And I never have an answer.
But that is something really good that I've always seen you teach the students, which is the idea that the actor needs something to interact with. Even if you're going to completely change the kitchen and you're going to completely digital it, give them one there on set to interact with, because you'll get a better performance.
Yeah.
To ground everything.
Yeah. It's the mix of practicals.
They have to have some context. And so you do as much as you can practically. But to do that full chase scene with Keanu running through the building, to try to do that practically would have been insane. Mm. And to do it totally digitally, at the originally the film was going to be released in August of 2004, and then it got delayed until February, I think, of 2005. So there was more time. But with the August schedule, I really had to limit how far we would go with the digital effects because we weren't going to have time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a it's a balance. You work it out, and sometimes you just say, let's put green everywhere and we'll have the actor show up and we'll do it.
Knock it out.
Yeah.
Well, give us one recent film that has just impressed the hell out of you.
A visual effects film?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a real favorite out of the last year, so it's kind of old news now. But Ready Player One.
Mm. Yeah.
Nice.
That Shining sequence, what'd you think about that?
Oh, my God.
That is like
just took my breath away.
Yeah.
And I knew how they did it. Uh-huh. And I thought, I'm looking at the screen, I'm watching for all the things that are going to give it away. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Interesting.
It's perfect.
Interesting.
That's cool. Now I got to go back and rewatch that.
Well, I got to tell you, because a couple of weeks ago, it's my fiance's favorite movie at the moment. So I'm really huge into home 3D, which actually I have another question in a second about that. Ready Player One has so much information going on that I think if you see it regular or 4K or whatever, I really don't think your brain can compute it unless you see it in 3D, where you could actually focus on all the things that are going on on the screen.
Yeah.
And that's why I love watching things in home 3D. But I thought I saw in your IMDb, did you work on the Wizard of Oz 3D?
I supervised the 2D to 3D conversion, Wizard of Oz.
That's by far one of the best home 3D. Because here's the thing, Wizard of Oz is obviously a terrific movie, but I was so impressed when I brought it home and watched it in home 3D because – it's – well, the key to 3D is this, is everything in the frame is perfectly in focus the way your vision would be, whereas sometimes they post-convert something that whatever is in the foreground is in focus and everything in the background is blurry. So then when you see that in 3D, it doesn't look as well. And so Wizard of Oz impresses me because, one, every element is in focus and you're like, did they shoot it that way? Like, I don't remember that. And two, more importantly, in the original film – a lot of the backgrounds are paintings, matte paintings. Yet when you see it in 3D, this matte painting looks like a magical place that you could visit. I've never noticed so many details.
There was we did a lot of work on that.
And I mean, I'm curious, like how complicated was it? Was the original film fully in focus and like, you know?
Well, it everything that was in focus in the film originally is in focus. Everything that was soft is soft. We didn't change anything in terms of that. Depth of field remained as it was. But the film was shot as if it were a stage play. I mean, if you look at it, they're theatrical sets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, forced perspective, yellow brick road, heading off over a little rise and hill, and these flat sort of, you know, muffin-shaped mountains in the background. And so the first thing we did was we said, well, let's make those muffin-shaped mountains round, you know. Now, they're really far away, so you can't go very far with the roundness. But some are closer, and there were some other things. And some of the houses, like in Munchkin Land, they were just painted flats. Hmm. And we said, okay, well, we'll put all the dimension in those things.
Oh, my God.
That sounds so
we did,
painstaking.
And it looked terrible. It just looked terrible. Because it was painted like a set. It wasn't really painted like real good scenic painting. It was painted in this fantasy sort of way. So we had to respect the original design, and we dialed back the 3D on those things. This was just – I mean, I kept looking and I said, guys, we cannot do this. Can't do this. Let's play that almost flat. We'll play that almost like they're cards, and we'll just stack the cards up in space that way. We're not going to try to build extra depth where we shouldn't. And so we kind of found a place in the middle. Every shot was really carefully designed. The issue with the film is that there's only 674 cuts in a roughly two-hour movie. Mm-hmm. You know, movie today, if it's Michael Bay, it's 3,000 cuts, you know, and if it's Steven, it's even going to be, you know, 1,200, 1,500 cuts at least. So the shots are really long and complicated, going through from the black and white world into the color world with all those plants, and then the little munchkins start to rise up and the camera cranes up and you see – and it just dollies and cranes forever. That shot took a year.
Wow.
Yeah. No, because I again, next time you guys are over, I have to show you.
Yeah, I have to see this now.
What Wizard of Oz looks like in 3D. Yeah. Because you look at it and you have to imagine they spent so much money and so much time to do this because it looks better than I've ever remembered it looking.
Yeah.
Big part of it is the depth stuff. Yeah.
No. Did they ever do theatricals with it in 3D?
Yeah. Yes. I think they released it theatrically.
They released it for a week. It was at the Chinese in IMAX.
Ooh.
Now, the difference between converting a movie for home video and even for, you know, the movie that was released in, you know, 1:3:3, it was 4:3 aspect ratio, like the old movies.
Yeah.
And so it worked okay even in its native – the way it was meant to be projected with – we found a place where we're doing – there's a thing called depth budget where you spend the depth over the shot and sometimes you have to put 80% of it here and let 20% just fall apart. And so we worked out all this stuff so that it could work on a screen like that one over there, about 60 and 65 inch screen. Mm. And it also would work in a theater because it was really tall screen. It wasn't widescreen. It was, you know, the whole sides of the frame were going to be cropped and the audience is going to look at a fairly small image. And so we found a space so the same conversion would work for both. And then I got a call from, after we delivered it all, I got a call from Warner Brothers and they said, we're going to release it in IMAX. And I said, oh no. No. Don't do that. And it's going to be screening at the Chinese for a week in IMAX. I'm like, no. And we're going to do a big premiere screening. We want you to come. No. You don't want. And I said, please, it will not work. And they said, we already looked at it and it looks great.
Wow.
Did they lie to you?
Look great?
They lied.
They lied.
Oh, no.
Because believe it or not, this is funny. I went from a 60-inch 3D TV to 65, and 65 didn't look the same to me because I was still sitting in the same position. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I sat behind my couch that all of a sudden my 65-inch looked better because the distance really does matter.
Yeah. That's distance crazy. To the screen makes a huge difference. I used to always sit toward the back. You should sit no closer than 1.5 screen heights to the screen if you're looking at a 3D movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 2 or 3 screen heights is pretty good. And the depth actually starts to feel – you feel it more the further away you get.
Yes. Speaking of language.
Love it. Are you also cutting out little people like Walter Murch and placing it on your computer screen?
I wish so, yeah.
I guess Murch is related because he did this, the sequel, right? Return Dolls.
Oh, Return Dolls.
Yeah, he directed that. Yeah.
Which is crazy because we just mentioned the 546 class I teach now, and I co-teach that with the production designer from Return to Oz.
So. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Oz World.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about working on that was we worked on it so long, and it was a crew that – the studio that did the work was a company called Prime Focus, and I had been the CEO of North American Prime Focus prior to that, and we didn't have a good parting. So the fellow who owned Prime Focus was informed by the Warner Brothers that they were going to hire me to supervise the conversion, and he said, "That's fine, but Mike can't come in the building."
Oh my gosh!
They stood by me and said, well, he's going to supervise it. So, you know, figure out what you have to do. You can always screen it here for him. You can screen the footage here. But that means you have to stop everything you have to get. And they tried that for a few weeks and it was so bad. They couldn't do it. And so I wound up going over there. It didn't matter. You know, I didn't care. He shouldn't have cared. It was not an issue. But the fun part of it was that we loved the film. And we all had – by the end of the year or so, or more, slightly more, that we worked on the film, we knew every single frame of the film. And even though we don't watch the shots with dialogue, we knew all the songs and we knew the dialogue because we'd watched it a lot. When we would conform the film to check a reel, we'd watch it with sound because we wanted to make sure sound affects how you perceive the stuff. So we would run it that way. And so when we're reviewing shots in the theater at Prime Focus and it's silent, it's up on the screen, we're saying the lines, we're singing the songs, you know, and it was wonderful.
I would have spent a whole year singing Ding Dong the Witch's Dad.
It was so funny. You know, it's Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I mean, that was just great. That was really hard.
Yeah.
She leaned against a bale of hay, a big mound of hay. Hmm. So there's little strands of hay between her and the camera, little strands of her hair for getting in her hair. And she had the dog. It was hard.
Wow.
But, it,
that's terrific.
It was all worth it. You have an appreciator in Rob G.
I can't tell you. I love talking to you about this because nobody ever asked me about that film. And when I tell people they really have to see it if they ever can, they go, yeah, right.
It's one of like 5 3D Blu-rays I show scenes from when I'm trying to show people home 3D.
Yeah.
And honestly, I can't wait for the new Avatar movie selfishly because 3D TVs are dead now. Right. I have to buy them from Spain and freaking the UK. If anyone's going to bring it back, it's going to be James Cameron when the Avatar sequels come out.
I was so wrong on 3D TV. I thought it was going to be huge. I thought 3D so on television.
But it looks better at home than in the theater,
in
right?
The theater. Yeah.
See, this guy's all right.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us
thank
tonight.
You,
it's
You're
been
welcome.
An this absolute pleasure and something that we've never gotten to dive into on the show.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. And really don't forget, leave a kind review on iTunes. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
Kind being the key word.
Yeah.
Do whatever you want. But just leave us
thing,
a review.
Man.
Yeah,
thank
do
you.
Your thing. All right. We'll see you next week.
Thanks.